one's gonna be kissed. So on guard, who knows what the fates have in store.
Ladies and gentlemen, if we get you to take your seats, we're going to call the meeting to order for the Planning Commission for the City of Goleta for today, February 8th. If you'd all join me in the flag salute.
Ready to begin?
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
All right, so Madam Clerk, if you could lead us off with a roll call, I believe.
Thank you. Commissioner Daniels.
Present.
Commissioner.
Present. Sorry.
Commissioner Fuller. Commissioner Maynard.
Present.
Vice Chair Jenkins.
Here.
Chair Onan.
Here.
Thank you.
All right, so we're going to go right to public forum today. It looks like we do have several speakers. So the public forum is an opportunity for someone to come and speak before the Planning Commission on any item in this jurisdiction of the City of Goleta that's not on tonight's agenda. So if for any reason I'm calling you up and that's inappropriate, let me know. But I do have a few speaker slips that I've identified for the public forum. And if you are speaking to something that isn't on there, we would like you to have be in the public forum. So our first speaker tonight will be Dick Thurston, and followed by Lisa Love.
Now, if you're wondering why I'm bringing these, you'll find out in a moment.
All right.
Yes, my name is Dick Thurston. I've lived on Carlo Drive for over 46 years. I'm here to speak on the subject of the RV parking proposal. It turns out that my motorhome is not really an RV at all. It hasn't been used in that way for over 10 years and has since been converted into a emergency preparedness vehicle in case of disasters that we've all heard about that have been told to us by those authorities that advises to be prepared, not if, but when. And for instance, I almost had to do that a couple of years ago when the fires came down within a block and a half of my home. We were already in our motorhome, ready to go. Now, our motorhome is supplied with emergency supplies, food, clothing, water, supplies, including a first aid kit like this. And we try to bring as much with us as we can provide to other people in the community who might need it. We try to serve other people as well. Our motorhome has a 3-kilowatt electric generator that can supply power to the outside as an emergency power source. We are at this point looking into having a special lift on the back of our motorhome that can bring our 6-kilowatt portable generator with us to also provide emergency power. However, that needs to be in my driveway, so in case of an emergency, I can go get it and go. If it has to be someplace else, that is to the detriment of my family and our health and well-being. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. All right, our next speaker, as we said, was Lisa Love, and followed by Robin Tow, if I've said that correct.
It's Tow.
Tow, Robin Tow. So, Lisa,
yes.
You're up.
And Peter.
Okay.
We're going to speak together because
we welcome you both.
We're a team.
You want to introduce
yourself? No, you
can. My name's Peter Love. I've lived in the Goleta Valley for almost 30 years, and in the greater Santa Barbara area for more than 35 years. Got my PhD in physics at UCSB. I think this is a special place. I'd like to comment on two things. First of all, I'm appalled at the growth that's been happening in the city of Goleta for the last 5 years or so especially. I remember when there were vacant fields all around here. I worked at SBRC when there were lots of fields. And it seems like there's not much open space left anymore. We're on the western frontier. The Gaviota Coast is still undeveloped, thank God. I hope to keep it that way. And the second thing I'd like to comment on is that, again, the RV RV proposal, I think, would be a great hardship to many people in this community. We use our RV frequently. There's a lack of affordable and reasonable storage space in this area. So not being able to keep our RV in our driveway or nearby would be, I think, an extreme hardship. We use ours frequently. We take it on short trips all the time, longer trips less frequently. I know a lot of other people who have RVs that feel the same way I do. I think we need to distinguish between people who have RVs that are operable, well-maintained, and used frequently, or at least used, as opposed to RVs that are used or inoperable and used for storage or just not used at all, or perhaps for living in illegally. That's a different situation, and I can understand that. But for people who enjoy getting out on the weekend or, for a couple days or for a week, it would be a hardship for us to not have easy access to our RV. Thank you.
Thank you.
Do you want to say anything else?
No, I just think if you pay your taxes and you have your property that you own, that Goleta or any government should not be telling you what you can do have on it.
Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm. Robin Tao.
Hi, my name is Robin Tao. I grew up here in Goleta, was born and raised, went to DP. Left for college, went to UC Berkeley, and eventually returned. I like that Goleta's rural, ended up buying a house here with my husband, and we raised our children here. We have an RV that we use for day trips down to Leadbetter, where they have RV parking for us, which is great. We intentionally bought a house in Goleta that had a driveway that was long enough to accommodate our RV without hanging over into the sidewalk. And in fact, City of Goleta permits have allowed us to do the sidewalk and driveway widening to allow for it to come in and out, and we have the thickened cement to help support any weight that was a concern. So I know that the city did approve that back when we did that driveway expansion. But so I just wanted to represent myself and my family, and my mother also has an RV. We live nearby. She has an RV that is also in her driveway, so I just wanted to hopefully we can model a law after Paso Robles' law where it's allowed as long as it fits in your driveway and doesn't hang over and obstruct the sidewalk. Thank you.
Thank you. Another public? All right. So looks like we do have another speaker on public comment. John DiBenedetto. And if I said that incorrectly, I'm sorry.
Thank you. DiBenedetto.
Thank you.
I have also lived in Goleta for about 30 years out in Elwood for most of all that time. I've had a boat. If you know Elwood, the area itself has a lot of boaters. We have lots of boats out in the streets out in the where it's, most of Elwood Shores is very boat friendly. People have had a bad experiences trying to find boat yards. There's, as you know, there's not a lot of places to put them. They don't store well in boat yards. They tend to get vandalized. Like I said, I've had I've had many boats out there, and one of the main reasons I moved out into the western part of Goleta before the city was put together was the freedom of living out there and not really being bothered by ordinances. And I was a former member of FOTEC, Friends of the Elwood Coast. We had a lot to do with getting a city of Goleta, and the intention wasn't to have restrictions like this put on the people of Goleta. It's a small, small community. And I guess I don't know how to process this with the commission, but I'd like to really know what's driving this. certainly for the we started out with having our boats on the street. Most of us moved our boats off the street, put them on our driveways, put them in our garages as much as we could. But for most people, that's we've already done that. We can't move further than that. And I'd like to know, you know, what's really driving that, publicly let people know why that's a problem. We don't see it as one in our neighborhood. With regard to the, and I can't speak definitively about this. My understanding is that the ordinances and the zoning is a brand new document. I'd like to see if there's any way to get kind of a track change between the old county ordinances and the city ordinances to better understand the crossover. I mean, there isn't a document map, as far as I understand, for helping you find where you need to find other things. I think this is just a litmus test of the rest of the changes in zoning. We're asking people to find their individual small interests, but it would be good if there was a crossover document that said, here's where you can find your issue, you know, what you're going to be interested in. I'm going to go try to read 400 pages, but my guess is I won't find what I'm really interested in either. I only got here because someone took the time to go door to door and saw my boat parked in my property and said, you need to go to this meeting. So I think that would really help the community if there's some crossover documentation so that people could more specifically get to their issues as opposed to one at a time. Thank you very much.
Thank you. So just to make sure, I have another speaker slip. Carol, is it Carol Newman?
Yes.
Carol, did you intend to speak to the public forum or to one of the items on the agenda?
That's the same item I was going to speak to.
Well, then why don't you come up now?
I would appreciate that.
Hi, I'm Carol Newman, my husband Jay Newman. Raised in Goleta, I went to Dos Pueblos, City College, UCSB. I've been at Raytheon 30 plus years in the engineering group, and I've worked all those years to pay for my home. And I consider it my home. We have a boat, which we use. We take our whole family and our church group out sometimes to water ski. And I believe that's my right as a taxpaying citizen to have my boat in my driveway. And I also do not understand where these rules are coming from. Our boat takes up the entire spot. It's, what, a 20-foot boat?
Yeah, just driveway spot.
So it takes up the whole driveway, but isn't that my right as a taxpaying citizen? That's my question.
Well, yeah, we won't respond to you here now.
Okay.
But you have every right to make your comment here.
Okay, thank you.
So I just want to build on that, too. I echo the concern from the community to say, what is the purpose of this regulation and where is it the genesis coming from? Effectively, are we looking for safety? That I can see. You know, if there's something overhanging into a sidewalk, it's a safety issue for someone biking along or walking along in the dark. That's a concern that is of the whole community. But if something's not in that public area, not in that easement area, I think that they should, you know, have the right to put on your property what you believe to. What brings across a concern to me is, well, where does this stop? You know, it looks like it's becoming more of a homeowners association in a condo where they're going to say, okay, you can only have this type of screen door on your unit. You can only have this type of mailbox on your unit. You know, you have to color paint your house white so it matches everyone else's. The question is, you know, where do those rights stop? And, you know, where does common sense take over? So I want to make sure that there's a purpose for what you're doing and that it, you know, has a function to the community, not just personal preferences for a few people that consider them eyesores. But like you say, we've gone through and cleaned up the streets, taken them off of the streets. You go through the permitting process if you want to park on the street for longer than 48 hours. That's all appropriate, and we're all abiding by that, and I think that's reasonable. But like I say, take them past the driveway that we have them in right now, and you know, most of the homes that are built in this area don't have enough driveway space to put them any further away from the curb as they stand right now. So, like I say, we have to take a look at what's reasonable for the community, the way it's already been designed and developed in its current state. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
So before we go on to amendments or adjustments on the agenda, Madam Director, would you like to... My recollection is the city adopted an ordinance regarding large vehicle parking some time ago. So is this a reflection in the new zoning ordinance incorporating those standards?
No, this is on this is for on-site parking, not street parking.
Okay.
So the ordinance that was adopted years ago was for on-street parking.
Okay.
So that is in section 1739, so that'll be a section that you, the commission, will look at probably either in the next meeting or the meeting after, and there'll be, it'll be on the agenda when you get to it. Just to answer another comment that we heard, there is a cross-reference document available. There's, it's an 11 by 17 matrix that actually should be sitting out on the table. It goes through the existing code and points to where in the new code the same regulation is with whatever new data is applied to that. So it's also available on GaletaZoning.com. It's a free download. So I just wanted to make sure that people knew that that was available.
All right. And so we'll have these comments readily available when we get to that portion of our zoning ordinance. Commissioner Maynard.
I know that we get these wonderful staff reports at the beginning of the meetings. Would it be appropriate to, on the next agenda where the RV parking issue may be coming up, if we could ask the staff to highlight the differences between any existing guidance and what the new zoning law is? If you could walk us through that in the presentation at the beginning, is that appropriate?
I think we can ask for that. And we, like we said, we have the comparison data within our packets. So we have that information available. But let's get back to our current agenda. Thank you very much for taking the time to come in and make your comments today. It does make a difference. So do we have any amendments or adjustments to this evening's agenda?
No, we do not.
We do not. All right. So, Madam Clerk, let's read our administrative agenda item.
Thank you. Item A1 is the Planning Commission minutes for the Planning Commission meeting of January 25th, 2016.
All right. And before we go that, you'll have the record show that Commissioner Fuller arrived just shortly after we started up.
6:04.
Good job. Happy to have you here.
I apologize for being here.
That's all right. Any discussion or comments on the minutes? Obviously, these minutes are quite detailed because of the amount of discussion we have.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I don't want to throw a monkey wrench in, but I spent all my time focusing on the item for tonight, and I did not get a chance to review these minutes. If the rest of the commission is comfortable with them, last time I found a few discrepancies, being that they're so detailed regarding section numbers. So I would wonder if I couldn't request that we continue these until next meeting. But like I say, I don't want to be the one that's driving it necessarily. So if the rest of the commission is comfortable, I don't want to stand in the way of that.
Postpone it. I think that's the request, that we postpone it. And I don't think that that necessarily creates any issue for us procedurally. Does anyone have a comment from the staff, whether that's an issue or a concern? Director Carmen, any problem with us?
Not at all.
Okay. So we have had, in essence, a motion.
Okay. Second.
And we have a second. So any discussion on the motion, which is to defer those minutes for approval till our next meeting? Not seeing any discussion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Aye.
Opposed or abstained?
Aye.
Looks like we're unanimous. So we'll move those back and we'll revisit those for our next meeting. All right. So now we're into the workshop phase. And Madam Clerk, if you'll read that item for us into the record.
Item B1 is a public workshop. It's the review of the draft zoning ordinance, part 4, regulations applying to multiple districts.
All right, so I think we'll pretty much follow the same format that we have been, which is get our staff report, and then we'll go to the public and allow the public to make their comments, and then we'll come back and we'll work through the process with the commissioners. So who's leading the way?
Good evening, Chair and Commissioners. It's my pleasure tonight to introduce the third workshop for the city's new zoning ordinance. It's been a long haul to get to where we're at tonight, not just with the workshops, but all the work that was done before the workshops starting back in 2014. And we have a distance yet to go. But when we get there, we will have the city's real first zoning ordinance that reflects our general plan. So this is definitely a noteworthy spot that we're in right now, and 2016 has its work cut out for us, but it's good work to do. As a reminder, we've already had two workshops. We've had a public open house, and we've had multiple stakeholder meetings. So for members of the public that didn't know this, if you're a stakeholder, a group, a homeowners association, whatever it might be, you can give us a call and ask for a stakeholder meeting and meet with us about whatever your issue might be on our draft zoning ordinance. The phone number to call to set up a request a stakeholder meeting is 805-961-7548. And we also have a website that Ms. Carmen had previously mentioned at GledaZoning.com, and it has this information on it as well. Or you can just call City Hall Front Desk, and they'll get you to the right person. We've also met with the Design Review Board. We're meeting with them tomorrow, or Ms. Carmen's meeting with them tomorrow as well. So I wanted to mention, this is the third workshop. We also have another open house coming up on February 27th. That's a Saturday, and it's all day. So 9 to 4, staff will be in here in the same format that it was the first open house that we thought was really helpful. We have informational stations with our planning staff and some staff from other departments to be able to convey information to the public and then get input from the public. And we got some really good, had some really good conversations that we've recorded and that we're meeting and talking about internally. Let's see. So I wanted to make sure that that people knew that we have a sign-in sheet. Wendy, is the sign-in sheet circulating yet? Oh, she's going to get it right now. And the reason that it was a public workshop, so it's a little bit more informal like that, but we want to make sure that people can sign up and give us their emails so that we can make sure that you're on our email list. You get email blasts of information about when our next meetings are, about when the open houses are coming up. Another example is when we know that we have another Planning Commission workshop in 2 weeks. When we know after tonight, we'll know what materials we'll be discussing at the next meeting. Before the end of the week, we'll release that information like we did for this workshop out to our email list and post it on GledaZoning.com. So it won't be part of the staff report, but packet that will go out later. We want to make sure people have as much time as possible to know what we're talking about at the next workshop. So we really want your emails. If you can sign up, that would be great. When Wendy comes back, she'll be circulating that sign-in sheet. Tonight we're reviewing part four, and that is that those are the regulations applying to multiple districts. And our consultant, Martha Miller from RRM, will be presenting with you a PowerPoint slide like typical. I think I covered all the details, and I will just turn it right over to Martha so that she can start the presentation.
Great. Thank you, Chair and members of the Commission. I'll just go through a quick, very quick summary of the chapters that we're reviewing tonight and really leave the bulk of the time for the discussion of the issues. But we're discussing the first part of the first kind of chunk of part four, which is a very thick section in your zoning ordinance. So we're breaking it into pieces so we can hopefully get through some of these. And again, just as we start these, we always like to remind ourselves of why we're here and why the city undertook this effort. And it was really to do a comprehensive update to the zoning ordinance, to bring it in compliance with the general plan, to implement what's in the general plan, and bring everything kind of up to date so that it's easy to use and understand, that it actually refers to the city versus what you have now, which often refers to the county and the Board of Supervisors. But it's really a zoning ordinance that is of the city of Goleta, implements the vision established in the general plan, and is enforceable, easy to use, understand, and brings everybody on the same page. As Ann mentioned, this is the third workshop. We're on to part four, the regulations applying in multiple districts. So making our way through. So the first chapter in part four is general site regulations. And this is really kind of a collection of regulations that apply generally to development throughout the city. So kind of regardless of what zoning district you're in. And it covers things such as accessory structures, buffers adjacent to agricultural districts, building projections, height projections, fences, outdoor storage, refuse, recycling, and green waste areas. Just a lot of these kind of aspects of development that most development has, and it has the parameters for it. I just want to mention a couple things we'll go through in more detail when your commission goes through, but the refuse, recycling, and green waste and storage areas, we did receive a number of comments at the open house and from some commissioners in how this applies, and we really need to look at this section again and kind of better articulate what's applicable to single-family residences and what's applicable on developments that are three or more units. I think there's some clarity that could be brought into that, as well as we're working with the Public Works Department on the stormwater issues, both involved in this section as well as the stormwater management section there, to make sure that those are really intermeshed and we're not doing things that the stormwater program does, or, you know, that making sure that those are really working together and that are consistent. And there'll be other questions on that, but we can walk through. Coastal access, this is really, this chapter is for the requirements for the dedication improvement and public access. This is really a Coastal Act requirement. And so every, all of the standards within this is intended to implement the Coastal Act for vertical, lateral, and bluff top access. So there's standards for the location, the design, the dedication, and how that happens. There was some comments of there's some other things in the general plan related to access and why aren't those incorporated here, and that it's really because those were more programmatic things or in improvements that the city may do, but what's in here is what is required of private development that it comes through. And so there's really a nexus to the level of development, the type of development happening, and the requirement for that. And again, this is really a Coastal Act-driven set of standards.
Excuse me.
Uh-huh.
So your discussion says you've used the Coastal Act. And our coastal land use program, right?
Right.
Okay. So I appreciate that, for one. And two, is it a Coastal Act and zoning requirement, and are they the same thing?
Well, so the city, kind of on a parallel track, is mm-hmm. working with the Coastal Commission to get a certified mm-hmm. local coastal program,
right.
of which this section would be part of the implementation program.
Okay.
So, yes, this would be the same thing.
Thank you.
And it brings me to a point I was going to make later. There's some of these sections that really are, really driven, not only on the city level, but on the coastal level. And the comments received from the Coastal Commission will affect how these take form as well. So what you're seeing and maybe what you're commenting on, just know that Coastal Commission will have input on that as well, particularly Asha when we get there. But Coastal Zone Visual Resource Protection, this is requirements for the preservation of significant scenic and public views. Again, consistent with the general plan, your local coastal program, hopefully that you have that at some point, and the Coastal Act. And this is really applicable to development on or adjacent to scenic and visual resource areas. Those are identified in the general plan. So at the time you went through the general plan, there was a lot of work done onto identifying these areas and coming up with the appropriate review processes and development practices to preserve those scenic views. Density bonuses and other incentives. This is really kind of straight state law, really. The state has an affordable housing density bonus program, and this is what is implementing it, consistent with your housing element. Kind of that works with this, the inclusionary housing program, which is also another program in your housing element to get more affordable housing within the city. That's what this section implements. And while the housing element sets that program, this provides more of the details of how that program, how it happens, how it's implemented, and the details. So there's requirements on unit restrictions, construction standards, performance security, how are we going to make sure that things get built, how they remain affordable. There are incentives and concessions that are outlined in there that the Planning Commission, through their review and consideration, could give, all with the intention of making it possible and incentivizing the construction of affordable housing. There's a section on demolition and relocation, which really has the procedures for demolition and actually defines what that is. Interestingly, we do need to define what demolition is because it's, you know, at what point is something a remodel versus a reconstruction, particularly in the coastal zone where demolition is considered, quote unquote, development. So you actually need a coastal development permit to demolish something. But this also establishes where if you had something non-conforming, and sometimes the difference between whether it can be built or not depends on whether it's demolished or not or reconstructed. So this sets out those parameters for that. And it's really to provide clarity so everyone's on the same page. And then the environmental sensitive habitat areas is a long section that really incorporates a lot of the detailed policies from your general plan on the sensitive habitats. And again, your general plan does have a lot of detailed policies on this, and those are incorporated not always word for word, but the intent of the requirement and the requirements are incorporated. Again, the environmentally sensitive habitat areas, or ESHAs, are very sensitive in the coastal zone, and Coastal Commission has a lot of input in that. And so staff is working closely with the Coastal Commission kind of on the policies and seeing what how Coastal kind of feels about them. But you'll likely be seeing input from them on the specific standards and what classifies as an environmentally sensitive habitat area. And then there was some questions on some policies in the general plan related to shoreline development that maybe should be in this section, and that's actually in a later section on shoreline development. So that's different there. So that's just kind of a quick overview of the chapters that are scheduled for discussion tonight, and we're happy to go into more detail on specific questions that people have.
Okay, thank you. So we're going to go to public comment on this section that we're going through today. And of course, if you have something to add beyond just what we're dealing with today on the zoning ordinance, you're welcome to do that. I do have a soft limit of 3 minutes per speaker. I said soft limit, so if you need to go over that, we'll make some allowance for that. I'll call up Cecilia Brown as our first speaker, and followed by Dr. Ingeborg Cox after that.
Thank you. Good evening, Mr. Chair, Commissioners. I hope you that you got my comments, and you wanted them in written form, so I took some time to do that. But I have some specific questions that I would like to pose just as emphasis. And the question is on outdoor storage. Nowhere in the code do I see any sort of regulation of the pods, those enclosed storage things that sit in people's driveways, in their front yard setbacks, at the curb. And I'm just wondering what kind of regulation we can have for those so they don't sit there for a year and a half or a year. Sometimes people use them as a storage facility for who knows what, just as an extra place to put stuff. So I'd appreciate it if there would be some discussion about those, and if there could be some regulation. If someone is remodeling a house, then they should be able to get, when they have a building permit, some allowance to put their whatever they need to do in there as a time that it's being remodeled. But just as a regular storage, extra storage place, I think it's sort of defeats the purpose of having it in your driveway, because we have other things in the driveway or even on lawns, which is where I've seen some of these things. Also, I'd like to speak to ag buffers. what's being proposed is very inadequate. If you really want to protect ag, I've given you a bunch of standards that would be helpful to incorporate into your ag buffer requirement. And hopefully you, perhaps that you've had an opportunity to go look at the county's ordinance, which is 5 pages, you have less than a page, that outlines detailed standards in terms of things like what you can put in the buffer, how big the buffers have to be, you've got to maintain it, there've got to be notice to property owners that there is a buffer here and some things, other things that they have to do. There's got to be landscape lighting and irrigation plans. So it's a little more complicated than just establishing a buffer. You have to have requirements about what goes in and how to maintain it. And the only other question I have is on protection of beach and shoreline habitats. And I think Martha talked about shoreline habitats. What about beach? I see in the general plan it's policy CE7, but I don't see any corresponding information in the zoning ordinance about beach habitats. Maybe it's the same as shoreline habitats. I'm not sure, but if you could respond to that too. Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Ingeborg Cox. And you'll be followed by Reverend Doug Miller.
Mr. Chair, commissioners, the City of Colita has already prepared the City of Colita new zoning ordinance draft supplemental EIR. The primary purpose stated in the draft EIR is to determine how the impacts of the general plan would change if the proposed zoning ordinance was adopted. Currently, the Planning Commission is discussing and making changes to the zoning document. So why is it that a draft EIR is already available? When the draft EIR was created, the persons preparing the document could not know what you are going to change in this zoning ordinance. Now I'm going to address some issues. Chapter 17.25.020, accessory structures. These structures can be 12 feet high and will be higher than an allowed fence height. If placed within the rear residential setback, that will violate the setback and create problems for the neighbor's privacy. Why is this being done? Allowing these accessory structures to have plumbing for washer, dryer, two sinks and a shower, and electrical to run the appliances, in essence, you are creating a second dwelling unit. This will most likely create problems between neighbors, and the city will get involved in more litigation. Figure 17.25040, could you please reflect the correct rear and side setback? Chapter 17.25050.C, minimum lot area and width. Stating that the same standard will apply if the lot area is divided equally is less confusing than the draft language. 17.25060, substandard lots need to be subject to the same setback requirements as a standard lot, and that is not stated here. Figure 17.25080. Why are backyard fences not mentioned? Figure 17.25080A is confusing. Could you please tell me where is the sidewalk? 17.25090, mixed-use development. Because of privacy considerations, the upper story step backs need a total height for the structure, as well as have a minimum step back of 15 feet all. You have 15, 10, and 5, if I'm not mistaken. 17.26040, access easement specifications need to address violations, please. 17.28030, administration and procedures under point B7, the required term of affordability, state the number of years that the government code requires. Do not ask the reader to go to another code. Can the City Council please change the number also? Because right now we don't know what are the numbers that you have to have an affordable unit. 17.29060, under incentive. Who is the approving authority? Won't this incentive destroy the setback requirements? I just have a few more lines. 4.47. It should not be the director who approves changes in the size of inclusionary units or reducing the cost of the interior amenity level. Chapter 17.29110, adjustments and waivers should not be between the developer and the director. Specifically, if it would constitute a taking of property, this is up to the city council, not the director, or you, the planning commission. Will the city of Goleta regulate HIV vegetation removal, specifically if there is no development? The zoning administrator should not be the one regulating projects within or adjacent to HSAS. It should be to the planning commission or the city council. Thank you very much.
Thank you. So Reverend Doug Miller, followed by Steve Fort.
Chairperson, commissioners, thank you for this opportunity. I represent the Greater Santa Barbara Clergy Association. A year or so ago, we voted for the housing element, which included 235 low, very low income, and that was divided evenly between very low income and extremely low income, so that would be 117 units. Now, in the inclusionary section of the housing section on page 39, it talks about 5% extremely low and very low income housing. Now, we would like to see that stated in the ordinance that this is split evenly between extremely low and very low. Otherwise, a developer would simply choose the very low and leave out the extremely low. And we're concerned that the extremely low get a fair sharing. So we'd like to see that evenly split between those two things. The other thing I raised last time, and it wasn't commented on, so I'm a little nervous about it, is the community assembly, in which the times are 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. This will run a great hardship on our congregations, our mosques, our temples, and our churches that have prayer vigils, all-night prayer vigils, that have Easter sunrise services, that have early masses and late masses, and we hope that that will be addressed and that there will be no time limit on worship in our congregations. We feel that this would be a violation of separation of church and state to regulate worship. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay, Steve Fort.
Yep. Good evening, Chair Onan and commissioners. Thank you for the opportunity. I'm Steve Fort with Suzanne Elledge Planning and Permitting. We've been engaged with monitoring the process, and you may have heard from a coworker, Maruha Clense, who has also participated here. And I just have some general comments tonight that we will be following up with some more detailed written comments. To start, I would just say, just suggest that be mindful of absolutes and kind of open-ended requirements. And like it was said before, be flexible to react to the merits of each project. Keep it easy to use and understand, and with some level of certainty for the public who's using the document. And I'm just going to go through with some general comments. I'll start with accessory structures. We didn't see mention of guest houses, artist studios, hobby rooms, music rooms, that sort of thing. We thought that ought to be addressed in here, along with, can you stack and combine accessory structures with other structures? And another note in that section that talks about putting an accessory structure on another lot that an owner might own, why not provide for that second structure on the other lot to be reused in some fashion and not have to be demoed if the property owner sells the property? On the upper story setbacks in the mixed use section, it has specific setbacks for different types of rooms. And just suggesting, does it really matter what type of room? You know, that could be really challenging when somebody's trying to negotiate into a project, into a tight space, and they're confined by the type of room that they can put in the setback. The right to farm covenants, we just echo Ms. Brown's comments. In terms of, I'm sorry, I meant the ag buffer section. I would just echo Ms. Brown's comments on that to the right to farm covenant section. And there's another covenant also. We would just suggest maybe running that by the county surveyor and the county recorder, because it can be really burdensome when you're at the end of the project, you're trying to record a map, and all of a sudden you come into a glitch with those two entities. And I would just suggest run that language by them and make sure they're not going to have any issues with that at the very end of a project when someone's trying to record a map that's already been approved. In the screening and buffering of common lot lines, it seems like there is a requirement that
even single-family residences will have to abide by a very prescribed sort of screening method, and that seems a little bit burdensome for single-family owners. In the stormwater management section, it does refer to the city's management plan, but it just seems like there could be some more referral to actual requirements to give people an idea of the scale of their project and what they might be required to actually do based on the scale of their project. And if I could just go a little bit, I don't have too much more, thanks. In the inclusionary housing section, in the land dedication option, and perhaps this is strictly following state law, but we just wanted to point out, why limit, if there's going to be a land transfer, why limit it to be within 1/4 mile of the proposed original development? If we're getting affordable housing, we ought to be more flexible in terms of where it can be within the city or even anywhere on the South Coast. And then there's a requirement that in the land dedication section, under that option, if someone's dedicating land, they have to have the approvals, or most of the approvals, related to the dedicated land at the time that they're getting the approvals for their actual project. And I would just ask to kind of look through the logistics of that, and if there are any real burdens that could generate in the future. And just a couple more things under the requirements for a restoration and monitoring plans under the ESHA and bio section. It just, before it lists the requirements, it says those plans must include the following, and I would just consider who's going to be using this and the fact that there ought to be some flexibility there for some of these plan requirements may not be applicable to every type of project that someone's bringing forward. Kind of along those lines, my last comment with regard to development standards and ESHA and the impacts to ESHA from fuel modifications, it seems pretty strict that no impacts to ESHA would be required from fuel modification. And that can be a very burdensome requirement for somebody with a smaller lot and they have ESHA on their lot. And that 30 to 100 foot fuel management zone doesn't necessarily require clearing. You can maintain and improve ESHA in that fuel management zone. So just some things to consider, and we will follow up with some written comments as well. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, let's go back to staff and see if staff has anything that they wanted to respond to or comment that came in from the public comments just now.
Sure. We've just been kind of talking amongst ourselves. We have a few things that we thought we would clarify. First, for anyone who doesn't know, we have the clerk takes the detailed minutes, and then we also have Andy Newkirk, who's in advanced planning, that's typing notes, and then we meet after the meetings and go over public comment, because sometimes we acknowledge like Dr. Cox talking pretty fast, and a number of you. We're having to put a lot of information out. So we're typing it out, and then we meet and go over everything afterwards. So we want to make sure that you know that things are not lost. We've had a lot of comments here and otherwise on outdoor storage and the pods. And we recognize that section needs to be clarified and cleaned up. I just wanted to point that out since we have had a lot of comments on that. This Thursday is a hearing for the supplemental EIR, so we're required to do environmental review for the zoning ordinance. So Thursday evening here at City Hall, we'll be reviewing the quote impacts of approving the new zoning ordinance. And so you're all welcome to come to that, of course, and the EIR is released. And it is on GledaZoning.com. There's also hard copies at the library and at our counter, so you're welcome to come and review that supplemental environmental impact report. Let's see, lots of good ideas. I'm just looking at all my notes. I'm like, lots of really good ideas and things for us to talk about. There's one thing that Ms. Miller is going to clarify on accessory structure. That's also been kind of a theme comment that we've received.
Okay.
On the outdoor storage in the pods, and Anne's correct, we'll clarify that section, but section 1725-100 does apply to the storage for more than 72 hours. So anything stored for more than 72 hours is subject to that section, which in the residential districts requires storage to be within a building being closed. So you couldn't leave those pods out indefinitely. As far as the accessory structures, so the current regulations do allow accessory structures to be 12 feet, and they are allowed in the rear setback. One difference is with this, it would also be allowed a certain distance into a side setback. That's a change. The plumbing, electrical, and those types of things are allowed within the accessory structures. When you think of people have plumbing in their garages, maybe some people have laundry facilities or a workshop. Some people have showers in their garage. They shower off before they go in the house after working or so on. So that's to accommodate that. Accessory structures, we can clarify, it does include hobby rooms, detached, you know, any kind of detached accessory structure. So we can expand that description of it. Backyard fencing, the graphic doesn't show a specific fencing for the backyard because, and this is consistent with your existing regulations, there is no separate limit for fencing in your rear setback. The regulations right now are for your front and your, I believe it's just street side, and then it says any other portions on the lot. So there's no distinguishing thing for the backyard, which is why that's not illustrated. The density bonus, one of the reasons why it refers to the state code for the percentages is, one, because state law does change and those percentages do change, and so it's not always a set standard that doesn't get updated. And also, I understand that the direction from the city attorney was, or the preference, is to refer to state law when something's in state law. Let's see, just a clarification on the adjustment on page 47. It's actually the Planning Commission that makes the decision. It's the director that, when a developer demonstrates to the director that there would be a taking, it basically allows that to go forward, but the ultimate decision maker is the Planning Commission. And that's detailed in D and E, where the Planning Commission renders a written decision. So just some clarification on that. And that was as far as I got in my notes.
Okay.
And to add a couple things, there was a question about, or a comment on the affordable housing breakdown for extremely low and very low. And we'll look at that, the housing element rules, and I think it is a 50-50 split, so we'll make sure that that's clear in the regulations. And then there was also a comment to run some of our zoning language by the county recorder, for example, also a really good comment, something that we'll work towards because I think we need to make sure that we're getting some of this stuff right, that they'll be overseeing.
Thank you.
Ms. Carmen, do you have any, you want to clarify anything that you heard?
Nope, I think you covered it.
Okay. Go ahead.
I just have one question, one quick comment that won't come up on the pages, so I just want to clarify. Reverend Miller brought up the community assembly, and is that in the section we've already reviewed, or that's coming up?
That will be in the standards for specific uses, so that's coming up.
Okay, wonderful. So we'll note that comment and make sure to bring that up at that point. And I also just wanted to thank, we got some wonderful comments from SciWest Development that are from the last section, but we didn't get a chance to talk about it in the last section. And I verified that those will be noted. And when we go through the second round of this, we'll be able to bring up these comments. So I just wanted to thank SciWest Development for submitting those comments and make sure that though we're not going to talk about them today, they will be noted.
Thank you. Okay, anything else from the commission here for staff? before we get into our page-by-page review. Did anyone come up with a better way to do this over the last 2 weeks since we've been here? Okay, just thought I'd ask. So if not, we're going to kind of try and go through it where we ended up in the last meeting. So that means that my job is to move us through it rather quickly. Of course, your jobs are always to make the comments that you believe need to be made. We're not necessarily going to go have the educational or debate portion with staff unless it's kind of an issue that draws more of us in. That will help us go through the timing. In other words, the philosophy or the regulation behind some of it will come through the process, but we're not necessarily going to stop our review at each step of the way, much like we did at the end of the session the last time. So you understand that my job's in a little bit in conflict with your job, which is to move you through and then you guys to make the comments as you see fit. And of course, I have my own comments that I'll be making. But when we have that conflict, just make sure that I'm aware of it. Okay, are we ready? So we're going to go to, I don't think we need to do anything on the, you know, cover port, the general site regulations. So we're at accessory structure 17.25, which is page 2, section 4, page 2. Everybody there? All right. Commissioner Maynard, would you like to lead us off on that page? Did you have anything on that one?
Sure. I have... Yes, I guess my only question is that I know that given the limited affordable housing in our region, and I know that a number of folks are using accessory structures as additional housing, I guess I wonder a little bit about the realistic of the ways that we're restricting this, and I worry if it creates a situation where we actually do have people living in these units, but because they can't actually be rented, we're not necessarily reducing the number that are being rented. Instead, we're reducing the ability for them to have legal means to have a contract with the rent with the landlord in this case. So I guess I have some concerns about the realisticness of enforcing this, and we don't need to debate that. I just wanted to note that I'm concerned about that.
Commissioner Fuller, did you have anything to add?
Yeah, I had a couple of comments. I don't really have a problem with you know, like a shower in a accessory structure. I can think of several occasions when that would probably be nice. I do have a little concern about the 3-foot setback. You know, we have setbacks for homes and residences, which include garages and other rooms that are used for things, you know, that are attached to the dwelling that are not allowed in the setbacks. Yet here, you know, we're allowing separate rooms, basically, that could otherwise be attached to the structure and be subject to the setbacks, if I'm not mistaken, to be in the setbacks, and especially with a 3-foot setback. You know, I think that some neighbors might find that a little disconcerting to have a workshop, you know, just 3 feet, you know, from their yard where somebody's doing woodworking or something. So, my comments. Okay.
Thank you. And I will second the comment that came through public comment about the removal of a structure that's on a separate lot in the event of being sold. I highlighted that whether that's a necessity or not. Commissioner Jenkins?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I do have a few things on this page. I appreciate the fact that up in the definition above it says it's not including secondary dwelling units. I am familiar with several jurisdictions, and I won't mention names, that are very aggressive against illegal secondary dwelling units, right? And so they have established preclusions to certain amenities in accessory structures. And I'm just thinking shower is one of them. To provide a shower, you are providing bathing facilities. And so these other jurisdictions will allow you to have a half bath, meaning a toilet and a sink, and that's it. The other thing is that we're allowing a washer and dryer in an accessory structure, and other jurisdictions may allow that, but you're allowed only one washer and dryer per home. Okay, so this is, in essence, allowing you to have a second washer and dryer. So staff might want to look at some of the language on that. I'm curious if we want to have, I know in the old ordinance, we had the provision for a minimum distance between an accessory structure and the main building. That was 5 feet. I don't know why we're eliminating that, but staff might be able to answer that. Under the 1 year, let's see, the temporary accessory structure cannot be used for more than 1 year in connection with construction of the development. I'm wondering if we should allow a provision for an extension on that. And I, too, have a problem with the 3-foot side yard allowance. I'm still a big proponent for the 10% side yard deal with a minimum of 5, so long as you're averaging that setback. I know the old ordinance allowed you to encroach into the rear yard. It didn't specify how much, so I appreciate having a specific number. I would be in favor of allowing the rear yard encroachment down to 3 feet, but I think the side yard should be given a little bit more thought. I think 3 feet is a little close on that. So, Mr. Chair, that's all my comments on that page.
All right, Mr. Daniels on page 2. Did you have any comments?
Commissioner Jenkins jumped on my discussion. Thank you.
All right, so Commissioner Daniels, we'll take you to the next page and let you lead us off on page 3. Do you have any comments on that page?
No. Thank you.
Commissioner Jenkins?
I don't, Mr. Chair, but I do want to go back to one item on the last page, and I appreciated what the representative from SEPS said as far as perhaps adding additional items listed under the applicability paragraph at the top, artist studio, a few other definitions I think would be appropriate there. So, thank you.
Okay, so I do have a couple comments on this page. So the 12-foot height is a concern, and obviously some accessory structures, which would include something like motorhome canopies and covers, and these would even exceed 12 feet in height. So that height structure, how do we deal with that? And then the agricultural buffer, which I'm seeing on page 3. I guess that concept was just a little bit new for me, but the whole the requirement within that agricultural buffer is, I guess, well spelled out. I know we had public comment that was looking for more detailed within that buffer zone. So perhaps that satisfies my concern there. Mr. Fuller?
I have one comment regarding the 12-foot height limit, especially if we're going to be encroaching into setbacks, maybe a one-for-one reduction in the set, or one-for-one increase in the setback for every foot above the height of the fence or something, so that taller accessory structures are set back further than shorter accessory structures. Just a thought.
Okay. Commissioner Maynard?
Thank you. I'd like to talk about primarily the agricultural buffer. I'd like to see a specific minimum distance for the buffer as well as a standard buffer, much as the way we do as distance from creeks or from eshes. I'd like to see under number A2, where it says the current crop type and agricultural practices in the agricultural parcel will be considered, I'd like to know if pesticides and fertilizers and how those are being applied would be considered, as I think that would affect the health of the folks next door. I'd like to recommend that the buffer be determined by the Planning Commission rather than the zoning administrator, but based on the advice of the zoning administrator, as I'm always excited to get the feedback from staff. And I'd also like some more specific language about the allowable uses in this buffer, and just to echo some of the comments earlier that I think a little bit more details needed in general in this section.
Chair Onan?
Yes.
If you wouldn't mind, can I have our consultant explain a little bit about agriculture buffers?
Certainly.
Okay. Thank you.
So the purpose of agriculture buffers is to protect agriculture. So that buffer is never placed on the agricultural parcel. It's always placed on the parcels around it. And Goleta's in really a kind of unique situation for an agricultural buffer because they are typically where you see in more rural areas. And it's hard to see on this map, but if you look at the agricultural parcels, which are in dark green, most of them around it are already developed into single family, you know, small lot, single family residences. There's a couple aspects where there's some development parcels or some parcels that could be subdivided. On those, you would go through a discretionary permit where there would be CEQA and the agricultural commissioner would weigh in on the appropriate buffer. And they take these considerations as well as many others into consideration. They'll detail out what exactly can happen within that buffer and all that, and there'll be agreements. The other cases that you get, though, are the small, you know, 7,000 square foot lots that are often already developed. And so kind of that question is, what kind of buffer are you really looking at there? What's possible, what's feasible, and what makes sense? And that's why this language for an agricultural buffer is so different than what you see in a county ordinance or in an ordinance that's dealing with much larger parcels where you can actually do more things on.
Okay. Yes, Mr. Ford.
Yeah, I just want to voice that I have a little concern that, you know, we tend to place the burden of use on the people who are doing the using, not on the people next door. And so, you know, it would seem to me that it's more appropriate to have an agricultural buffer on the agricultural property and not on the neighbors. Just my take on that. Thank you.
So we are, as always, implementing our general plan, and the general plan is kind of a driver behind protecting agriculture use since we don't have a lot of agriculture in the city. So that's where you're seeing some of this language is coming from, not specifically this detail, but we were trying to effectuate that direction in the general plan.
Staff, is there any Right to Farm Act that falls into play here as well?
Yes, and I think we'll be getting to more detail on Right to Farm.
I mean, is that a state ordinance?
Yeah, it's a requirement.
Okay. Yeah, mm-hmm. Okay. So is that why you're putting the buffer on the adjacent property as well?
That's an addition, right, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I see. Okay.
All right, so we're on page 4. Commissioner Maynard, you're going to lean us off on page 4. You get first round of comments there.
You'll love this. I actually do not have any comments on page 4.
Well, it makes me feel like we're missing something.
Well, thank you, but I'll still pass.
Okay. Commissioner Fuller.
I will defer to Commissioner Jenkins.
Okay. Commissioner Jenkins?
Just one, and that is under the table, allowed building projections into yards. Question under bay windows. Is that a cantilevered bay, or is that at floor level? And there can be a world of difference. So also, I'm a little on the chilly side. I don't know if we can turn the air conditioning down a little bit. Thank you.
Wendy catches that. Commissioner Daniels.
Negative.
Nothing on that page. So I do have a comment, just basketball rims and backboards, no closer than 10 foot of the street-facing property line or 5 foot from an interior side or rear property line. I don't know why I guess it's 10 foot tall, so it's visible, but I'm just concerned about restricting the recreational activity in someone's backyard. So let's move on to page 5. Mr. Daniels, you want to start anything on page 5?
No, I'll let Commissioner Jenkins go ahead.
I hope you got anything here with Mr. Jenkins. Oh,
only one. I'm going to disappoint you eventually here, I think. Okay, under the figure allowed building projections, third from the bottom, it says no projection is permitted beyond maximum 3 feet from the interior lot line. And I would just add after a comma or rear lot line. Hmm. Which I think is agreeable with the other information in this.
And that's in spirit with the having some setback on the rear?
Yeah.
And the same thing?
Assuming we're going that route, yeah.
Okay. Commissioner Fuller?
I'm good.
Okay. Commissioner Maynard?
I'm good.
So just a question. I've highlighted decks, porches, and stairs. Those encroachments, are you all comfortable with those? I mean, Commissioner Jenkins, you probably run into that in your work. Mm. And the difference between 18 inches above ground or above ground level or elevation. So is one of those really a concrete type situation versus elevated decking, or how does that function?
18 inches is usually the guide for a building permit. So if it's below 18 inches, it's not considered. It doesn't need any sort of permitting. So it could be decking. It could be elevated concrete. It could be steps. But okay. that's where the 18 inches comes into play.
You're not concerned with any of those?
Well, I am concerned about getting things too close to property lines, especially side yard. Not okay. so much rear yard, because we have greater distances that we're dealing with in the rear. But I do have concerns when we start getting too close to the side, but I don't have a problem with a porch element that's under 18 inches. So.
And saying that it could go 8 feet into the rear yard, is that my reading of the table? Is that correctly mm-hmm. correct? That's the maximum size, 8 feet.
Mm. It's the maximum encroachment into the rear yard. So you could have a larger deck only, but once you hit that rear yard set. The required rear yard, the setback.
Okay. Yeah. That's where I missed it. Okay.
So that would be a little more clarity if it said rear yard setback rather than just rear yard, because otherwise people think they can only have an 8-foot deck, right? Yeah.
Okay. So that looks like page 5. We're going to go to page 6. Commissioner Jenkins, you get to lead us off in page 6.
I disappoint you?
That's not at all.
Nothing.
Okay. Commissioner Fuller, anything on page 6?
I'm good.
Commissioner Maynard?
I do have comments on page 6.
All right.
Under other energy production facilities located on rooftops such as wind turbines, I noted that, skipping ahead a little bit to page 7, mechanical equipment penthouses is 10 feet, elevator and stair towers is 12 feet. I wonder why we're not giving as much allowance to renewable energy as we are some of these other opportunities. So for me, I'd like to see the energy production facilities be able to go to the same height as mechanical equipment penthouses, as an example. So that's my reason for skipping ahead a little bit there.
Okay, got it. Anything else on that? No. Commissioner Daniels?
Yes. Top of table 1725070, two blank spaces up on top. I suppose it comes from the two on page 4, but why not do it again? I mean, they're just blank. Okay. They're blank in my book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay.
So thank you.
I do have one comment on item D, exceptions, when it talks about a lot being located in two zoning districts and requiring a modification. And in this, it looks to me like we require then that we have a conditional use permit, which is, of course, at the burden of the owner of the lot. That happens to be burdened by this because it falls in two zoning districts. So my concern there is we really have a regulatory function that we put in place on someone's property, and then they have a burden of a conditional use permit, which, as we know, has some significant time and cost impacts to a property owner or those wishing to do some modification on that. All right, so we're on page 7. So, Commissioner Fuller, you get to go first.
I'm good.
Nothing on page 7. Commissioner Maynard?
Just that the athletic field lighting, I believe later in the program we'll get to talk about dark skies, and I know there were some public comments on this issue, so I'm going to hold more detailed comments for that, but looking forward to that component of these regulations.
Okay. Commissioner Daniels, anything on page 7?
Chair, I believe I started the discussion and change on page 7. Thank you.
Yep. Those are noted on the top of the page. Yes. Commissioner Jenkins, anything on 7?
Yes, I had a similar observation to Commissioner Daniels on the blanks up there, but also under the in the middle of the diagram or the table, it talks about architectural elements such as spires, bell towers, and domes.
Mm-hmm.
To me, those are very similar to chimneys, decorative features, cupolas, pediments, obelisks, and monuments. Mm. And I'm just curious if they shouldn't just be lumped together. I think the 20% is probably more appropriate than 5 feet.
Mm-hmm.
Additionally, chimneys are chimney heights are driven by building code. Chimney has to be 2 feet higher than the closest roof within 10 feet. So you have a little bit of a code situation there, but anyhow, that's all I had on this one.
Okay. All right, we're going to the next page. Commissioner Jenkins, why don't you keep us going on page 8?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just had, let's see. My question that I made a note to myself was, what about 42-inch high picket fences on a property line? And I don't know why I wrote that, other than the fact that don't exceed maximum 6 foot high. You caught me off guard. So what about 42-inch high picket fences on property lines? Are those going to be regulated?
Okay. Mr. Daniels, anything on this page, page number 8?
Only that 1725080A fence and wall heights. It was a little difficult for me to process all that. Thank you.
Okay, Commissioner Fuller, anything here?
Yeah, two things. One, I'm not sure if we want to continue, but apparently we do have like design guidelines, you know, in the zoning ordinance, because that's what I'm seeing here. I have a personal sort of aversion to concrete block and its use in construction. I don't know if you'll support me on that or not, Commissioner Jenkins, but just about anything is better than concrete block, in my opinion, whether it's decorative concrete block or split-faced or slump stone or, we've got lots of sandstone in the area, which makes a great surface, and it's very attractive. So there you go.
Okay. Commissioner Maynard?
Just to echo the important separation between design and zoning.
Okay.
Yeah, and I think Commissioner Fuller's comment about the block is a design issue, so I would defer to DRB on that.
Okay. So Commissioner Maynard, why don't you go take us through page 9 if you have anything there?
I thought the public comment about the specificity of room types here was interesting, and I wonder if it's needed to get into this level of specificity.
Okay, thank you. Commissioner Fuller?
Yeah, I like the idea of the differentiation between the rooms. You know, when you are doing a mixed-use development, you're likely in a commercial area, and so having a living room that's closer to the street may not be, you know, might actually be something that someone would prefer. You know, but when you have a sleeping room, you know, you probably might want to be further back from the street. So I think that's actually a pretty good idea, personally.
Okay. Commissioner Jenkins on page 9.
Well, I just would remind Commissioner Fuller that it's not talking about front yard. It's talking about interior and side. So it's not from the street. I could go either way on this. I appreciate that we're spelling it out and offering suggested distances. I'm just curious, you know, is this enforceable? You know, and if it is, how? When you get an initial plan, you allow it, but someone could put a bedroom in another residential room and we're not going to enforce it. So I'm just curious if it's necessary.
All right. Commissioner Daniels, we're on page 9. Did you have anything there? No?
Go ahead.
All right. Yes, back to page 9 or going to page 10?
Just back to page 9.
Yes, sir.
You know, you might have a residential, I mean, we're talking about mixed use here. So, you know, you might have a commercial building and, you know, next door, and even your sleeping room, you might want to have, even if it's interior, you might want to have it further back from a commercial use next door, or an office building, you know, that might be standing up there with windows, you know, looking your way. So just a thought.
All right. Commissioner Fuller, you have earned position number 1 on page 10.
Okay. Well, I guess I get to lead off on the pods.
Yes.
So, I think including, you know, by definition, pods or containers, right? I mean, you know, you could use shipping containers. People do that. Just noting them in the first line there, you know, storage of goods, materials, you know, and storage facilities, or even trailers, right? But I think trailers are now we're starting to get into another realm. So I have that. I did like on B, the setback of 1 for 1. You know, I mean, if somebody has a 15-foot high RV and they're parking it right on the property line, I can understand how a neighbor might not be thrilled about that. So, you know, having a requiring a setback. I know the owner of the RV may not be thrilled having to keep their RV, you know, maybe 5 or 8 feet away from the property line, but, you know, he's got a neighbor, so.
Okay. Commissioner Maynard, comments on page 10?
I'd like to just note on the RV conversation that I believe that the specific regulations on RVs are going to come up in the next section, so I have some difference of opinion there, okay. But I'd like to hold that until we get to that section. For the outdoor storage, I think the word open storage in that first line is a little confusing to me if it's including pods. The other thing I was thinking about is if you're, say, doing a renovation at your house and you bring out a dumpster to an extra dumpster to collect construction waste, I wonder if 72 hours is going to be enough if we're including that type of dumpster container in the same category. So I think there's some more thought needs to be on the timing if we're getting into some of those other types of storage containers.
And actually, just because this was mentioned before, the next sentence says, you know, temporary storage of construction materials required for construction work, that would be included, the dumpster, yeah. So that's exempt.
And in the definition of outdoor storage, except for the keeping of building materials reasonably required for construction, so they're not even included in that definition.
Thank you for clarifying that.
Okay. So page 10 to this side of the table, Commissioner Daniels, anything on page 10? Mr. Jenkins?
Yeah, just one, Mr. Chair. Under outdoor storage, open storage of goods, materials, machines, equipment, and vehicles or parts outside of a building for not more than 72 hours must conform to the standards of this section. So I had a note to myself saying, can we park a car on our own driveway? And, I mean, it's very similar to the RV discussion, which is later, but I want to park a car in my driveway. And so you can't limit me from, I mean, we have a two-car garage, but we also have, you know, children who drive, and so we have more than two vehicles. Most of the garages in Santa Barbara, or in Goleta, which used to be the county of Santa Barbara, are not 20 by 20, which the city of Santa Barbara requires. They're less. And so the practicality of parking two vehicles in the city of Goleta in a lot of situations is tough because you're dealing with less than 16-foot wide garage doors. So in my home, I park a motorcycle and a car inside my garage, and I park on my driveway. So I have a real problem with that.
And sorry, this is some clarification too. I think it should be inoperable vehicles, as Commissioner Maynard mentioned, parking vehicles is
small detail. Okay.
All right, yeah. Well, let's add
it later. We'll have the parking issues later.
Right, and then this is really about things. I think inoperable vehicles will clarify that, yeah, in the intent of this section.
Okay, Commissioner Maynard.
I'm not sure that I would actually agree that inoperable vehicles should not be allowed in your driveway for more than 72 hours. I guess I have quite a few colleagues that are car buffs and they like working on cars. And it seems like on somebody's own property, if they're keeping it inside the sidewalk zone, I would not have a problem with that. So I'm just going to note a discontent there.
All right. So Commissioner Maynard, we're on page 11. Did you have any comments on page 11?
There. So under 1725.110, the third line, there's a typo. Waster should be waste. And then under C, for location and orientation, all solid waste and recycling containers enclosures must meet the following requirements unless the zoning administrator determines that compliance is infeasible. Would that be something that we could determine at the design review stage when this was getting developed? I guess if it was a change later down the line, I'd be more comfortable with the zoning administrator doing it, but it should be part of the design process.
Okay. Mr. Fuller?
I'm good.
Mr. Jenkins, page 11.
Nothing to add.
Mr. Daniels, anything on page 11?
No, Chair, thank you.
All right, Mr. Daniels, page 12.
Yes, page 12. This is probably from Commissioner Jenkins, but I see under D, materials, construction, and design, and then we've got minimum heights of screening, enclosure material, gate material, access to enclosure for residential properties. You know, I think all those 8 and 10 are design. And I refer to you to let me know if they are or not.
Okay. Commissioner Jenkins?
Mr. Chair,
page 12.
Yeah, page 12. Let's see, I had a note here under number 2, visibility. The solid waste and recycling storage area cannot be visible from a public right-of-way. And I had a note saying that contradicts 1 on the previous page. It says location of solid waste recycling to be located within any required front yard, street, side yard. So is that a contradiction? And then under D1, we're talking about including a roof structure, and I just had a question, why? Minimum height of screening. And then I circled 2, just stating under D2, stating that's definitely design guidelines. Under D4, access to enclosure for residential projects, each solid waste and recycling enclosure serving a residential project must be designed to allow disposal appropriate receptacle without having to open the main gate enclosure. But it's 6 foot tall. So how can you get in there without opening a gate enclosure if it's 6 foot tall? So that's all I have on this page.
Okay. Did we go through everybody on this page?
Nope.
No. To your side of the table? Go ahead.
No, you go first.
I have a few comments on number 2, visibility. If the enclosure is fully fenced in, I'm not sure what the issue regarding visibility is because we've given guidance about screening already. So really all you're visibly seeing is the screening. So I guess that's a thought that I had on that one. On D... I'd like to add language about pest management protection. I work out at the university, and most of our problems with litter related to recycling and refuse is because a raccoon got in there and caused havoc. So I'd like to think about that. For D number, that's on the next page, so I'll hold off on that one. And I would like to respond to number D1, minimum height of screening and including a roof structure. I believe the reasoning behind that is because of stormwater management issues. And I know for my apartment complex, there is no roof on it. And I would hope that the lids of all of the recycling dumpsters would be kept closed, and they're never kept closed. So as soon as it rains, all of our dumpsters fill with water and all of that goes out into the storm rain. So those are some concerns I have in that section, and my rest go on to page 13, so I'm going to hold off.
Okay. Commissioner Fuller?
Yeah. So, I can't think of very, very many enclosures that have roofs, you know, that I've seen. So I just, you know, also it hinders access, you know, to the dumpster itself. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, unless the roof is really high enough, you know, I guess it's possible, but otherwise you're almost forcing people to take the things out to put stuff in them, let alone open the gates. Right, so I think maybe some more thinking on whether that is a requirement. You know, they do have, according to the rest of these design guidelines, a drain that, you know, goes to the sewer. So, you know, it may not be the best use of the water, but it is getting funneled somewhere other than in the street under these design guidelines. And I think anybody, you know, should be keeping their lids closed on their trash things, just, you know, for sanitation purposes. But and then, yeah.
That's it?
Yeah, well, I was just going to second Commissioner Jenkins, you know, accessing it without opening the, you know, the enclosure. How do you access something without opening the enclosure? So that's okay. It.
Commissioner Maine, we'll go back to you and start on the next page. Page 13, I think you had some comments.
Yes, I will continue with my stormwater management comments. So we've added a drain for the drainage, the floor of the enclosure must have a drain that connects to the sanitary sewer system. I wonder if we need a filter on that to catch any large litter. I know whenever I go to the sanitation department's booth at Earth Day, they tell me all the things I'm not supposed to put down in my sewer. So mm-hmm. I'm wondering if large pieces of trash would create problems there. Also, there's some language, which we'll get to a little bit later on IV-20, that is in the stormwater management section, but specifically relates to trash storage areas that I thought was maybe helpful here, or at least helpful to refer to here. On that later page, it will say that trash storage areas shall be designed using best management practices to prevent stormwater contamination by loose trash and debris. And so I feel like there should at least be a reference to that other page here.
All right. Commissioner Ford?
Right. Number 10 at the top, at the travel ways. It doesn't say what this is applicable to. I mean, we have single family zone, you know, a 62,000 pound, you know, maybe we should make this for, you know, things that are dumpster oriented or, you know.
Okay. Anything else?
That's it.
So I've highlighted the floor drainage because obviously that is connected to the idea of covered or non-covered. If you're going to have floor drainage, then you got to have covered because it's exposed to the, that's a pretty big requirement. Mm-hmm. Not maybe on new construction, but certainly should something rise to the level in existing conditions, because running sewer service to that could be very difficult mm-hmm. in existing situations. So I'm not sure how that tracks through the whole process, but that's my highlight.
Existing situations are exempt unless they're doing significant work on their property.
But wouldn't a complete reconstruction of your containment, your trash containment area, trigger that?
Not necessarily.
Hmm. Okay.
That the would square be, footage we, requirements under stormwater rules aren't that finite yet. They will probably get there eventually.
Because that's a tough one.
It is.
Not on new construction again, right. But anything other than new, that's a big requirement. Commissioner Maynard, do you have anything else Commissioner Jenkins, page 13?
No, Mr. Chair, you brought up the point I was going to make concerning roof or no roof, sanitary sewer system or not. So if you're going to do that, obviously you can't have stormwater if it's unroofed flooding the sanitary sewer system. So,
anything from you, Mr. Daniels, on page 13?
No, Chair.
All right, so Mr. Daniels, why don't you pick up page 14 and see if you have anything there?
I do not. Thank you. Rights of research covenants, no.
Commissioner Maynard? Commissioner Jenkins, sorry. I apologize.
You have a challenging role. So you're excused. I just had under B1 and the subparagraph in there, the property within, this is a notice, I'm assuming, to surrounding property owners regarding CCNRs, that they're noticed that there is potential hazards or things that are happening that could be of discomfort to them. And I'm just curious, retroactively, did we apply that standard to Cortona Apartments? Because they're in an industrial zone area, or is that, it's not an issue because we're talking new versus existing?
Correct.
So, okay, mm-hmm. Thank you.
So before, I have to admit that the research covenants, I didn't completely understand the applicability. So what is it we're referring to? What kind of a facility is this?
So this actually gets to something that will be described or discussed later. It's the Sustainable Living Research Institute, which some members of the public were bringing up that was an interest to have, and this was related to that. So we may talk about the relevance of this maybe when you talk about that, which is in standards for specific uses, I believe. But that's what it's related to.
Mr. Chair, can I have a minute?
Yes.
Thank you. I'm guessing you probably had some additional research done by our staff lawyers and on this issue, the rights to research covenant. I mean, you would have had to, so.
The city attorney did review the entire.
Thank you.
I recall this discussion in our first modules that was brought forward, and these are almost variations on the living type conditions and stuff that we see as norms today. So we're going to see alternate applications in residential areas or directly?
We might. I mean, we had a lot of comment in the modules. There's a lot of public input on this, and we're continuing to get that input at stakeholder meetings. So this was our attempt to kind of convey that input to you so that you can look at it and consider it.
Okay. Commissioner Fuller, you're on page 14.
Nothing.
Okay. Commissioner Maynard?
I would just say that looking at the definition of the sustainable living research site and then looking at this covenant here, if I was a subdivider or a homeowner and I read this description, I wouldn't picture what was in the sustainable living research site. And I know it's, I guess what I struggled with this is that it's, it really unsure exactly what's going to happen on the sustainable living research site, so it's hard to say what should be in here now. So I realize the vagueness and the difficulty of this, but I'm wondering if the language could maybe refer to the definition or incorporate more of the language from the definition that you've got in the zoning here. But I'm not sure if that works legally, so that was just an impression that I had.
Okay, we're okay? So, Commissioner Maynard, why don't you take us on to page 15?
I do not have any additional comments for page 15.
Commissioner Fuller?
Yes, I do. On the table, and I have to refer to page 16 also.
Okay.
In the single-unit residential, you have, when it butts up against another single-unit residential, that it's required type 1 screening, which appears here to require two trees for every 100 feet on each side of a lot. So I'm not sure how many homeowners really want to have them, you know, the requirement to be planting like up to four trees, you know, on each property line, on each side. They may not like trees, you know. They may like sunshine instead. So I'm just... Maybe you could eliminate the, you know, that cross-reference there for type 1. And then down at commercial with multiple unit residential, there's no requirement you know, there's a requirement there. And I would think there would need to be some requirement between commercial and multiple unit residential. That's it.
Okay. Commissioner Jenkins, you on page 15?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I just have an observation. I'm comfortable with us discussing screening, but when we get into specific plant materials and location and number of trees, which is following up on the next page, I think we're getting into design guidelines a bit, because the DRB addresses not only the architecture, they address landscape as well. So I do have some follow-up questions on 16, but that's my preamble to that.
Okay. Commissioner Daniels, anything on 15?
Yes, I think Mr. Fuller and, excuse me, Commissioner Fuller and Commissioner Jenkins have touched on it.
Okay.
Thank you.
So, Commissioner Jenkins, take us to 16.
Yeah, if we're going to include all of this information in the zoning ordinance, I'm just curious, under the table at the top, under trees and shrubs, there's numbers that are listed. Are those the number of trees and shrubs? Okay, so I think we might want to, because it talks about mature height of 40 feet or more, and then it says two and two. So it's not clear, so I studied that for a while. And then are we requiring both trees and shrubs? And if so, we should have the diagram below reflect that. So you're just showing trees only. If you're wanting shrubs as well, show the shrubs too. But again, I think I almost wanted to defer it to DRB.
Okay, Commissioner Daniels, anything on page 16?
No, thank you, Chair.
All right, Commissioner Fuller?
Width reduction for adjacent landscape buffer. I don't understand why, you know, somebody should get the benefit of their neighbor providing a buffer. And in some ways, you know, the more buffer, the better. You know, if you're going to require buffers, let's require buffers and have everybody do their buffer and not let the first guy in, you know, give a benefit to the next guy because he was in there first. Just.
Okay. Commissioner Maynard, anything on page 16?
Whereas I do feel for the second homeowner in that case, I think if a buffer exists, I wouldn't want to add an additional requirement to the second developer.
All right. So, Commissioner Maynard, why don't you look at 17 and see if you have any comments?
I just had one clarifying comment for 1725-150B4. Is the use of wood restricted because of fire safety? That's a question for staff. Or is that aesthetic?
I believe it was fire.
Then I support that and have no other comments.
Commissioner Fuller.
If I may, for Commissioner Maynard, why not just reduce both property owners' buffer requirements if they're going to be adjacent buffers, and then they can equally benefit as opposed to allowing one to have a special privilege? But just that's a comment on that.
My only concern would be figuring out the logistics of that and how to plan that buffer together.
Okay. If staff could just add, in my previous experience, I have seen cases where if there is already a buffer that exists, the existing landowner with that buffer does not want anything planted that would take away from the look of their buffer. And therefore, they would actually want it more than the new homeowner who might actually want to plant something. I mean, I have seen that in different cities that I've been in. So I think because this requires a written requirement, a written agreement, it would necessitate cooperation between the two, and there would have to be some discussion. But we could also consider a reduction by written agreement of both of them. But one, if one was coming in and there was already a buffer there, I don't know if that person would be interested in tearing anything up.
Back to 17, if I may.
Sure.
Again, I have a problem with like concrete block, whether it's decorative or and concrete panels. But that's a design, potentially a design guideline thing. New walls tend to be graffiti magnets, and requiring some, this goes to design as well, but, you know, some form possibly of a graffiti-resistant coating on them, you know, to make it easier for people to get graffiti off, if there such a thing exists.
Okay. Anything else on 17?
No.
Mr. Jenkins, anything on 17?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, E at the top is definitely design guidelines. Down under 1725150A2, I'm going to suggest that we remove the or at the end of that sentence because of the fact that it's stating the zoning administrator may waive or modify screening requirements or upgrades to existing mechanical equipment or condominium conversions. So the zoning administrator, I don't think, wants to address condominium conversions. Mm-hmm. So, and then at the bottom of the page, I think we should allow wood in the use of screening. There's many beautiful woods that are used up there, can be used horizontal, whatever, a lot of options. They can be handled to be fireproofed in an assembly that addresses separation and hours and duration, but I would allow wood to be used in as a screening material.
Hey, Mr. Daniels, anything on 17?
Yes, once again, I'd like to Commissioner Jenkins' eyes to see if B on 17, B 1 through 4, is something that would go to DBR.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good. Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Mr. Fuller.
Yeah, if I may, I apologize. I just have a question. The city doesn't have any requirements for backyards to be fenced, does it?
Nope.
Okay, so that's totally the property owner's. Yeah, okay.
Okay, page 18. Mr. Fuller, you get to lead us off.
I'm good.
Good. Commissioner Maynard, page 18.
And no comments on 18.
Commissioner Jenkins?
Yes, Mr. Chair. This is architecturally related. Under the roof-mounted equipment 1A, it states that multiple equipment screens or hats surrounding individual elements will not be permitted. I think it's kind of restricted, and I think it limits creative design options by stating it has to be monolithic. I could see where creative design could introduce some other elements that the DRB might address. And if we go that route, then under the diagram, I would add language, you know, or series of architectural similar screened units. That's all I have.
All right. Page 18, Commissioner Daniels?
Negative.
And anything on 19?
Me as well?
Yep.
Negative.
Commissioner Jenkins, 19.
Under 3, I would just, it talks at the end of that paragraph, this requirement does not apply to fire-related elements, and I would just think of parentheses with examples of what are fire-related elements that you're talking about.
Okay. Commissioner Fuller?
Yeah, I'm just slightly curious that under what situations of 5 feet height exception might be needed for photovoltaic installation. You know, I think any photovoltaic should have some design review. I'm completely for them, and I think everybody should have them. I just think that some consideration should be given to what the final outcome looks like. And so, you know, they're a pretty obvious part of our city, just like somebody's roof line is and roof material is. So
okay.
That's all.
Commissioner Maynard.
Sorry, I'm going to slip back into 18 slightly. Just as we were talking about that, it made me think of ground-mounted equipment as potentially, what about ground-mounted solar for a parking lot? Would that also need to be screened, and what would that look like? I'm not sure if this was really thinking about that. And it's being used in a lot more parking lots out in IV. There's a parking lot that has ground-mounted solar now. UCSB is about to do a large ground-mounted solar out on the field there by Harder Stadium. So I think I'd like to think about that a little bit more. And the screening of roof-mounted, because it's going to go, if it's at or above the height, I guess I'm wondering about solar panels that are at an angle and move with the sun. How do we make sure that, like, what's the height to match that solar if you've got the solar panels that move with sun? So I'm trying to think about how that works. So that's my comment there, which relates to my comments on IV19, 1725-160, the solar installations. I'm going to make a similar comment to what I had said before on wind and other renewables, that I think that the height of solar should be able to match the height that we allow for mechanical equipment penthouses and the staircases. It seems like solar is at least as important as those. So I want to comment on that, and that refers back to page IV7. I also noticed that when I read A1 and A2, I couldn't really tell the difference between the two, and maybe I got lost in the words there. But I'd love a clarification from staff of what the difference between A1 and A2 are.
So A1, they can extend up to 5 feet above the height limit, and in A2, it's 5 feet above the roof surface. So one, your ground point is the roof, and you can go up 5 feet. In number one, the point is the height limit of the zoning district, so you can go up 5 feet. In number two, the grounding point is the height of the structure, and you can go up 5 feet, even if that exceeds the height limit. Does that make sense? It's the reference point of where that 5 feet is measured from.
And I also just wanted to jump in and note that we're not allowed to regulate solar based on aesthetics. That is the law. So as much as one might want to, that is something that we cannot do anymore.
So did you have something else?
Yeah, I was just thinking, required setbacks. So solar panels aren't allowed in within yard setbacks? But their equipment is. I would think that, you know, allowing solar panels, you know, within 3 feet of a side yard line would be okay. But that's just me.
Okay. Anyway, we'll go to the next page. So look at page 20. Mr. Fuller, do you have anything on page 20?
I'm good.
Commissioner Maynard, anything on page 20?
So on page 20, there was a few comments in the public comment that, and I'll just give a general reiteration that I'd like to see where it mentions best management practices, particularly under the section B, and it mentions it for each of the points 1 through 5, that I'd like to actually see the specific guidelines of those best management practices spelled out a little bit more here, and more reference specifically to the stormwater management plan developed by the city. This felt a bit vague to me, so that was one of my concerns there.
Okay. That's it. Page 20, Commissioner Fuller, did you have anything?
I'm good, thank you.
Commissioner Jenkins, page 20.
Yes, Mr. Chair, a couple things. Under A at the top, in that paragraph, I'm not familiar with non-point sources, and I'm curious if we have a definition anywhere that would clarify that. I believe it's the last sentence in that paragraph. It seems a little awkward and wordy. Post-construction structural best management practices, blah, blah, blah. So I don't know if seems like structural might be unnecessary, but I'll let you guys figure that out. Under item 1, retention and detention basins, just basins to be consistent, I would say or, retention or detention basins. And then I'm curious if all six of these items, do those apply to residential development as well? I know other jurisdictions do require stormwater. So for instance, if you're adding onto a home, you're creating new hard surface. And so just the hard surface area, the new hard surface area has to be addressed, right, as far as stormwater runoff. So
the state is continually making that area smaller. So eventually it will apply to everybody.
Okay, great. And then does the city have different tiers?
Yes, we do.
Okay, great. And then let's see. Under B1, you say non-residential and multi-unit development must use best management practices. What about single-unit commercial? Do they have to use it as well? Just if you're saying non-residential and multi-unit development, what about single-unit commercial? So
non-residential.
Is this just residential?
No, it says non.
Non-residential and multi-unit development.
So any commercial.
All right. Okay. Thank you.
Good.
Yep.
Commissioner Daniels, anything on page 20?
No, sir.
How about page 21?
No, sir.
Page 21 to you, Mr. Jenkins?
Yeah, really minor. Under item C, we have 15 feet, 1.5, and then we have 5 feet written out. So I just think consistent numbers are words.
Okay. Commissioner Fuller?
I'm good, thank you.
Commissioner Maynard on page 21.
I do. For 1725-180A, exclusive use, I have a couple of comments. One, just in terms of where it's applicable, based on our last conversation, I don't believe that pools and spas are allowed in agricultural. Is that correct?
No, they are they're allowed as accessory uses. So I think when you're looking at the use regulation tables, those are primary uses of what you're looking at. So I think you're looking at recreational facilities, and they're not allowed.
Okay.
But like a residence is allowed in agriculture, and a swimming pool or a spa that is accessory to that residential use is allowed.
Okay. So then I guess would, okay. So then for a residential district where you are allowed to have a public pool, but it's not allowed because we do allow recreational facilities, which do include swimming pools, in residential areas, are we now saying that those must be exclusive and private?
It would be that you can't have a public swimming. While you can have recreational facilities in residential, you couldn't have a public swimming pool.
Okay, even though that does, I guess, public recreational facilities, that category does include the description of pools in our definitions in the back.
Right. But again, the use definitions, they're, designed to broader. Be broad and incorporate. And then where there's exceptions, those are detailed out. If you do want to, if the commission says, swimming pools should be allowed in residential, then this would just be changed to say unless part of recreational use.
Okay. So I would advocate for this to be public. I looked back at our old zoning code and the general plan. I don't see anything where this language was in our previous documents, and maybe I missed it, but I did look at some of the swimming pool sections, and I didn't see that particular line. Well, the other lines I did see.
If I could just clarify, that line is for exclusive use of a residential complex or facility, just like we're not going to make the pool that's available at Willow Springs a public pool. If there was to be a public pool developed in a residential area, it would just need a CUP that's listed in E.
Okay. I'll look into that more and communicate with staff offline about that.
There could be some clarification that could be done to A to make that very clear.
Okay, did everyone have a shot at page 21? Did I skip anybody? No? Commissioner Fuller, we're on page 22.
Thank you. Underground utilities, this requirement may be waived by the zoning administrator upon determining that underground installation is infeasible. That's a pretty variable standard. Infeasible in one guy's mind is totally feasible in somebody else's mind. It costs money. So I think maybe it should be a little higher up as far as a decision than just being waived by the zoning administrator.
Okay. Commissioner Maynard, comment on page 22.
I will agree with the last comment that was made and otherwise pass.
Commissioner Jenkins.
Yeah, the under visibility at intersections and driveways, you're stating 3 feet, the height of 3 feet. Obstructions should not exceed 3 feet in height. Is that standard? Because I'm more familiar with 42 inches, 3.5 feet versus 36 inches, and I'm just curious if the city is trying to go a little bit more strict.
No, our public works department, 36.
Really? Okay.
Yeah.
That's new to me. Thank you.
So that picket fence would just need to be on an angle in that particular project.
42, and it needs to be at 36, not 42, apparently. Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Anything else there, Mr. Jenkins? No? Mr. Daniels, anything on page 22 or 23?
Negative, Chair.
All right. Anybody else on page 23? Commissioner Ford?
Chair Onan. Kind of going back to the bottom of 22B. So we have 10 feet at an intersection, but 12 feet at a driveway. Just curious, if I may take the time of the staff, why do we have 2 foot more at a driveway?
Because you're often backing out. And so
you're
there needs to be.
Not supposed to, not on any new development. What? I thought we were supposed to have, okay.
How can you not back?
All right.
This is residential.
Yeah.
So, yeah, commercial, yes, I would hope you're not backing out.
Mm-hmm.
But on residential, typically you're backing out of your driveway, and so a little more sight distance is usually required.
Okay.
All right, so that included page 23. Anybody else have a comment on page 23? All right, so we're going to page 24 and 25, coastal access. Mr. Daniels, do you have anything on page 24 or 25?
No, Chair, as long as staff had the Coastal Act, California Coastal Act in mind when they wrote this. Thank you.
Commissioner Jenkins?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Nothing on page 24, but on 25, under 5, I think I would suggest removing or at the end of that sentence. And then under 6B, it talks about demolition or reconstruction of single-family residence. And I'm curious, it says it must be sited in the same location as the former structure. And I'm just curious, where does the 75-year setback issue come into play here? So if the bluff erodes further, you technically can't locate it in exactly the same location legally, can you?
Okay.
And then under 6D, I think we want to eliminate the word A in front of C-word. It's not C-word of the location, rather, not a C-word of the location. And then being consistent under item E, it's talking about the purposes of this section. Bulk means total interior cubic volume measured from the interior or from the exterior surface, and I would prefer measured from the interior surface. And if you don't, are you, if you're taking the volume and you're doing it from the exterior surface, are you excluding the attic or are you including the attic in that calculation? So that's why I think you're penalizing the person if, you know, if they have an 8-foot ceiling and there's a, you know, an attic space above it, you're counting that as bulk and volume and you're penalizing them. That's all I have, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Page 24 and 25, Commissioner Fuller.
I'm good.
Good. Commissioner Maynard, 24 and 25.
I think that Commissioner Jenkins made a good point about 6B. And it also occurs to me you should think about things like flood avoidance or other types of situations where somebody's had to go through a pretty dangerous situation on their property, and that's why they had to do the demolition. So I might think about other types of emergency language to use there to address the same concern.
All right. So why don't you take us to pages 26 and 27, Commissioner Maynard?
So in page 26, 1726040, in the general plan, there are also requirements about specific trails. And I think from the comments from staff earlier that those will be kept in the general plan. Is that correct? Okay, so we'll still be keeping that language. That's everything that I had for 26 and 27.
Thank you. Commissioner Fuller?
I'm good.
Commissioner Jenkins?
Only one item on 27, Mr. Chair, and that is under 2C, it talks about overhead clearance of 7 feet. And I'm just curious if we're allowing equestrian access, where we haven't mentioned that, but 7 feet is a little too short for equestrian use.
Okay, Commissioner Daniels, anything on 26 or 27?
Negative.
All right. So, Commissioner Daniels, why don't you take a look at page 28 and 29, see if you have anything for us there.
Again, this looks like something that lawyers have read over. Thank you.
Okay. No comments then?
No comments.
Commissioner Jenkins?
No comments.
Commissioner Fuller?
No comments.
Commissioner Maynard? 28 and 29.
On 28, there was some language in the general plan, OS 3.4, that talked about coastal access amenities. Again, this may fall into that category of that'll be kept in the general plan and not in the zoning code, but I wanted to make sure that those access amenities were still encouraged in this use area.
All right. That's all on 28 and 29. Let's bite off this section, pages 30 and 31. Commissioner Daniels, anything on page 30 or 31?
Nothing, sir.
Commissioner Jenkins?
Just one thing on page 31, D4, we're saying clustering of building sites and structures. And I just have a sense that if we require clustering, you may actually cause a visual impact. And so I'm wondering if the language should, you know, possibly read careful selection of building sites and structures. And then that would actually defer to go on towards the DRB, but that's my suggestion.
Okay. Commissioner Fuller?
Yeah, I've got a couple of comments, and they probably run afoul of the Coastal Commission's rules, but first, the following development practices must be used where applicable. I would prefer to see may be used or, you know, preferred or something other than must. The limitation of the use of reflective materials for exterior walls, including retaining walls. So they're talking about glass, right? Because that tends to be a reflective surface. So they're trying to limit the use of windows. So if you have a house that faces the ocean, you know, they want to have as little window space looking out at the ocean as possible. Also can affect, you know, some types of design. You know, the modern design likes to have a lot of glass. So, you know, some people may not like the idea of looking up and seeing a house and, you know, having the sun reflect off of it. But, you know, I'm not so sure that they can just move and then the sun won't reflect off of it. Also, I'm wondering why we have to, like, be really economical with curb cuts. What's you know, the point of minimizing curb cuts? I know that in the past, historically, shared driveways have been something that homeowners did not particularly like. And historically, in the past, they've reduced property values if, like, two people had to share a driveway, and then you always have problems with who's using it and what they're using it for and stuff like that. So I have a problem with that shared vehicle access to minimize curb cuts. So that's it.
Okay. So that's
our Sorry. I have one more. Selection of colors and materials that harmonize with the surrounding landscape. So are they talking about flowers? I mean, that's part of the surrounding landscape, right? you know, what part of the landscape are we going to use for the color combinations? Hibiscus red, you know, goldenrod, daisies, dirt. you know, I just don't like that idea. You know, this is somebody's idea of trying to make the house disappear, you know, when nature itself doesn't disappear. So.
Thank you, Commissioner Fuller.
That's it.
Commissioner Maynard, back to you.
Yep. So on page 30, there's just a typo under 1727.020 applicability. Coastal mesas needs to be corrected. And then on section D, so one thing that I'd say on D is that I was very excited to see that the language in this was carried over from the general plan and was very consistent, I thought, with the general plan. There was only one item that was missing from section D that was in the general plan but was not listed here, and that may be because it's going to be addressed in the lighting section later, but one of the view protection standards that must be used from the general plan was downcast, fully shielded, full cutoff lighting of the minimum intensity needed for this purpose, and that's from VH 1.3 in the general plan. I also wanted to note that on D3, in the general plan, it does say limitations of the height and use of reflective materials, and height and use was taken out, so I would like to see that put back in. Hearing all the comments tonight, I think one thing I would just make a general comment of is I think we should be cautious about changing too much of this language, because it was something that the community spent a lot of time in the general plan developing, and this does come straight out of general plan. So I guess that would be a bit of a concern of mine, of us changing too much of this language at this point. But I am curious about this windows being reflective. I think that's an interesting point. So I'd like some clarification on whether windows are prohibited in D3, because that does maybe sound like going too far for me. But I would advocate for keeping the language must be used where applicable.
Okay, so that takes us through page 31. We're going to take a short break here, 5 minutes, and we've got another 37 pages to go through. So we'd like to get this, if we can, get through this yet tonight.
Okay.
Don't worry, we're not going to keep you here if we can't, but we'll make every effort. So let's take a 5-minute break and come back. Bucket of candy. All right, we are on page 32 and 33. And Commissioner Maynard, why don't we start with you? Unless it's inconvenient, we can move to the other side. 32, 33.
I have no comments, or 32 or 33.
Commissioner Fuller?
I'm good.
Commissioner Jenkins? I'm good. Commissioner Daniels, 32 and 33.
No, again, this looks like it's something out of the housing element.
Yeah.
If staff can just add, this was a point of contention with our legal department about putting in the government code verbatim, which is something that I like to do because I think it helps readers. We will have an informational piece that does have the code, the state law in it after adoption. It just won't be adopted into the code. That way, if the law changes, we can just slip it in and out of the ordinance.
Okay. So, Commissioner Daniels, you're on 34 and 35, if you have any comments there.
No, sir.
All right. Commissioner Jenkins?
Just on page 34, item 11, it's just talking about target units and use of use restriction period, and I'm just asking for definitions on that. Just not familiar with those terms.
Okay. Hmm. Commissioner Fuller?
Yeah. 8, expiration of the agreement. Just don't quite understand that either. Doesn't seem, you know, the distribution of accrued equity for for sale units. Who is it getting distributed to?
Okay. And Commissioner Maynard.
On page 35, where it talks about required notice, I would like to have us optionally add notice to the public. I think there's a lot of affordable housing advocates that like to be able to track conversions. So if we could add a that the city would commit to giving notice to the public, either via their website or other area through your social media, I'd appreciate that.
Okay. All right, we're on page 36 and 37, Inclusionary Housing Program. Commissioner Maynard, are you able to make any comments on those two pages?
I have no comments on 36 or 37. I found them to be in line with the housing ordinance.
Thank you. Commissioner Fuller?
I'm good.
Commissioner Jenkins?
Nothing.
Commissioner Daniels?
Nothing.
All right. Commissioner Daniels, 38 and 39.
Nothing.
Commissioner Jenkins?
Nothing.
So I'm probably going to be in not in conformance with the general plan, but I guess it just seems that putting this in lieu fee on 2 to 4 unit developments is a, you know, kind of a heavy burden for people that tend to be paying a high price, you know, in almost every respect for either the opportunity to build 2 to 4 units as far as the cost of land, and then the cost of construction because of, you know, the economies of scale. You know, I mean, I'm sure it's in the general plan, and so I'm just, you know, making note of that. Also, you know, when you're doing 20% on like 6 units, you know, you come up to 1.2, and then you're going to throw a requirement of one additional unit, which they'll probably, you know, have to do an in lieu fee on in order to, you know, continue with the construction. Also, doesn't make sense to me. You know, having 1 unit for 5, you know, 2 units up, and then going not having an additional requirement until 10 units would make a lot more sense, and then you have 2 units, right? And so you don't end up with that fraction between 5 and 10, where it's also not very economical to do a development.
Okay, 38, 39, Commissioner Maynard.
I have a couple of comments. On calculations for inclusionary housing units, 1729040B, I may have been reading this incorrectly, but I think in order to be consistent with a page that we're going to talk about in a bit, page IV40B1, I think we need to say that at the developer's option, less than, if it's less than 0.5, then they can do the in lieu fee or roundup. But I believe that over 0.5, if I'm reading the other IV40B1, I think that's actually determined at the 0.5 level. So I'm looking for some consistency here. And then I'd also like to echo what Reverend Miller discussed earlier. With the affordability levels, that for 1729050A2A1I, that under the affordability levels, extremely low and very low income, that's supposed to be split evenly, and also same section B1I, extremely low and very low income, again, should be split evenly. These percentages, I believe, are in line with state law, so I would recommend keeping with the percentages rather than the recommendation that was just made. And I also, you know, given the number of community members that were very involved in both the general plan and the recent housing element update that was quite recent, I certainly wouldn't want to lessen any of these requirements, because that's something that both of those, we've had so much public process in the last few years on this.
All right. So, Commissioner Maynard, you're on page 40 and 41. Keep us going.
All right. So on page 40, if you're starting from the top of page 40 and do C5, I believe that these trade-offs should be approved by both the City Council and the Planning Commission rather than by the director. We have so little affordable housing, so to give up that affordable housing and trade-offs, I think that's something that the public process needs to be engaged on. And I'm supposed to do 41 as well?
Yes, correct? Please.
Okay. And then I'm curious about this land dedication option. I'd like a little bit more background. This might just be my naivete, but how does this equate to units that the building is, since it's not full building? Like, what's the calculation there, and is that, can that be referenced in another document? I believe there were also some comments about, so from the public comment, there was a comment about whether the land dedication had to be within a fourth of the mile of development or larger. I'm curious if that's regulated by law. I'd be willing to make that a little bit wider, but again, I'm not sure if that came from the housing element or law, both of which I would defer to. I think those are my only comments on those two.
Commissioner Fuller, 40 and 41.
I'm good.
Mr. Jenkins?
Mr. Chair, the only thing on 40 is I would respectfully disagree with Commissioner Maynard regarding five or C5. I believe that allowing the director to overview that is acceptable because we do have the process of appeal available. And I think we need to be careful when we, you know, throw everything to the Planning Commission or everything to the City Council, because it causes an additional burden. It's expensive for the city and for the applicants. So I would just respectfully disagree on that one.
Thank you.
Chair, if I might add, the housing element is clear that it's a director and it's for those reasons.
Okay.
And most of those projects are going to the Planning Commission anyway. It just gives a developer some guidance up front before it goes to the Planning Commission for a decision. Mm. So ultimately, you're going to see it. You're both going to get what you're asking for in many cases.
Sure.
Okay, so if the director approves the trade-off, but then it goes to the Planning Commission didn't want the trade-off, can they overturn that at that stage, or does it already defer to the original decision of the director to give the trade-off?
That's a good question. But I honestly don't see any sizable project going through our inclusionary housing ordinance without a development agreement, mm-hmm. which means it would eventually go to council. Mm-hmm. So it would be the director's recommendation, then your recommendation, and then council would make the decision. On a smaller project, I would suspect that it could be reversed by the commission, but then there could be an appeal. So,
just to follow up on the discussion, I like the process of it going to the director because it allows staff to, you know, is it supportable, you know,
well,
before
and
it comes to the commission.
In a community like Goleta, where the interest in affordable housing is so high, any decision like this would be watched very closely mm-hmm. and would be made in light of the policy issues that are surrounding affordable housing in this area. So it would have to be fairly strong reasons for any sort of trade-off to be able to happen.
Commissioner Daniels, did you have anything on 40 and 41?
Negative, Chair.
All right, how about 42 and 43?
Again, negative, Chair.
Okay, Commissioner Jenkins?
Nothing.
Commissioner Fuller?
Nothing.
Commissioner Maynard, 42 and 43.
Yeah, I think, okay, potentially some clarification of what was just described in that trade-offs process may be helpful to include when discussing trade-offs here, so I'll just note that. And then I'll hold my additional comments.
All right, so let's look at 44 and 45. Please, Commissioner Maynard, if you'd lead us off there.
This is a legal question, but for page 45, C2, I wonder if we are going to make an exception and allow rentals, if we could ask that it be rented at an affordable rate. But that might not be available legally, so just an idea.
Commissioner Fuller.
I'm good.
Commissioner Jenkins, on page 44 and 45.
Nothing.
And Commissioner Daniels, anything on 44 and 45?
Nothing.
All right. So, Commissioner Fuller, I'm coming back to you on 46 and 47.
Yeah, so I have a question. seems to me that under 1729090C, I think that's might be a stumbling block as far as financing goes, having an affordability covenant survive. Am I wrong? Could somebody look into that maybe? All right. That's and then let's see here. I have a problem, and it's maybe in stone in the general plan that I didn't look up. But on 47B2, you know, 15% is not a very big allowance considering the differences in prices for the units. So you're either requiring the developer to put either very basic minimal stuff, nearly minimal stuff in the for sale units, or spend a whole lot of money, you know, making the really inexpensive units very nice. And, you know, I don't think that that's, I think that's going a little far. I think that there should be I don't even think that should be in there, actually, as far as the interior differences, because one person's interior is their interior. It doesn't have anything to do with the rest of the building or the rest of the complex. And individuals obviously can upgrade their own interiors, you know, like especially in condominiums. And that's one way that developers have more of an opportunity to provide affordable housing at the price levels that we're asking them to, is when they can put in more basic finishes like fiberglass tub units versus tile or, you know, stone or marble. So I just wanted to, that's my opinion.
Okay. Commissioner Maynard, 46 and 47.
I think the language could be clarified around under B, where it says that the director may approve changes as follows, and I think there was some clarification in the reports that there's also a role for Planning Commission here, so I think maybe that language could be clarified on the decision process. And I would support consistency with the housing element in this section and not making the changes that were just recommended. I will respectfully disagree.
Okay, Commissioner Jenkins?
One item on page 47, the table at the top, the definition of bathrooms. I agree with the definition of the three-quarter bath, includes a sink, a toilet, and tub or shower. Hmm. Curious if you meant for the full bath definition, if you meant to say includes sink, toilet, tub, and shower, or did you mean a tub with a shower combo? So I think real estate, I think the industry standard is a full bath is those four items, four separate items, so a separate shower and separate tub. I like the idea of the combo tub shower in this situation, but I'm just thinking your definitions are a little, should be clarified.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Pages 46 and 47, Mr. Daniels, do you have anything there?
No, sir.
All right. So, Mr. Jenkins, how about you on page 48 and 49?
Nothing, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Fuller, 48 and 49.
I'm good, thank you.
Ms. Maynard.
No comment.
And Mr. Daniels, anything on 48 or 49?
No, sir.
All right. So we're now to page 50. Commissioner Jenkins, what do you have on page 50 and 51?
Just a general question, and that is, because we're talking about demolition and relocation, what about historically significant structures? Is that in a different section?
That would be in a different ordinance.
Okay. All right. So we shouldn't be making any reference to that other ordinance here?
Well, there are some references already to local registers or the Old Town Heritage District, but okay. I think based on, because we'll need a historic survey in order to accurately make those references. Okay. So post historic ordinance will either have a new section in the zoning ordinance or we'll add two sections like this, depending on how the ordinance comes out.
I'm just curious, and I'm comfortable with that. I'm just curious if a trigger or some type of hint to the public in this might be helpful, because other jurisdictions have, if a structure is over 50 years old, it needs to go to historic landmarks or needs to go for an archaeologist to review it. So
do have that under CEQA.
You do.
Yeah, 50 years is the evaluation threshold for CEQA.
All right. That's all I have.
Commissioner Daniels, anything on page 50 or 51?
Negative, Chair.
Commissioner Fuller?
I'm good, thank you.
Commissioner Maynard?
No comment.
All right, so we got 52. Commissioner Maynard, anything there?
Nope, I do have comments on 53 when you get to it.
Why don't you go for it?
Just one comment on 1731010E. Protect water quality and the biological diversity of Goleta Slough and Devereaux Slough. I'd like to see also language from the general plan, and there it said 4E. It went a step further and said N quantity adequate to supply natural ecosystem processes and functions. And I think that fits very well with the ESHA section and should be kept.
All right, Commissioner Fuller?
I'm good, thank you.
51. Commissioner Jenkins?
Nothing on 52 and 53.
All right. Commissioner Daniels, 52 and 53.
Nothing, sir.
So anything on 54 or 55, Commissioner Daniels?
55. No, sir.
Commissioner Jenkins?
Yeah, we get into the application requirements, and we're talking about distances from ESHAs and zones, and then they're required for all the biological study and analysis. And I left Ms. Wells a voicemail, which I don't know if you got a chance to listen to or not. It was about 3:15 this afternoon, so I hope you were home with your family. But my question is, I was thinking of a property that I did a remodel to in the Elwood area, okay, and it backed up to the Monarch Grove, right? If a property owner wants to add on to their home, wants to add a bedroom or add a second story, are they going to have to face potentially tens of thousands of dollars in studies to add to their home? And so I'm curious if there's any accommodation for existing development. I was thinking perhaps even having an ESHA overlay for existing development. I'm all for the review and the studies for proposed new development, you know, commercial and residential, but for existing mom and pops, they've owned their home forever, they've lived in this situation forever, their chimney is, you know, burning wood logs, you know, and which can affect monarch butterflies, and I'm all for saving the monarchs. But is there an accommodation for existing development?
Overview question.
Yeah. Existing development is existing development, so the standards for adding on apply, and you wouldn't be applying a buffer. That would be for new development in an area that's open and hasn't yet been disturbed. So an existing development already has its lot line, it already has its fences. If they have fences, they already have their units and their setbacks.
Okay, but if their existing home is within 100 feet of a habitat area in ESHA, are they still going to be exempt?
Yeah, if their lot's already been developed out, then yes.
Okay, all right. A little conflict in staff's nodding of the head and shaking.
Do you disagree?
Oops.
We have a disagreement.
Well, this isn't purely a city regulation. This is also in the Coastal Act and how ESHA's or coastal zone and how ESHA's treated. So. It's really the location of the habitat, and any development in which, under the Coastal Act, development is very widely defined and incorporates basically the placing of any structure. So any development would need to meet those requirements.
Well, that was my guess on that, and that's why I'm offering perhaps the city should look at an overlay that, you know, it wouldn't be difficult for us to know and recognize what homes are potentially within 100 feet of an ESHA. And can we come up with a reasonable set of development guidelines that a property owner could apply to a project, either prohibiting a second story or prohibiting moving towards the rear or whatever? Is there some means that we can aid in the understanding? And then, this also triggers similar noticing to new buyers that you're within 100 feet of an ESHA and you may not be able to add onto your home, you know. So, I think staff might want to think about maybe that design guideline, or not development guideline overlay, right, in the situation, and then or the noticing as well. So
Staff can certainly look at that. I think it may be more of a, once our LC, our local coastal program, is adopted and we have the ability to issue CDPs, there may be a way for us to look at an overall treatment, or even, you know, if we could obtain grant funding, a biological study out there that would affect those homeowners, and sort of have that in our back pocket. So if someone did come in for some sort of an addition, or we could go the design guideline route. I think there's a lot of options here, but we're fairly limited right now because the Coastal Commission does have authority, at least until we do have our LCP.
Understood.
Commissioner Jenkins. I mean, Commissioner. It's getting late or something.
Thank you.
But the ESHAs aren't all in the coastal zone. So other, you know, there may be a divergence between what requires a permit and what doesn't, and what would, you know, require all the ESHA applicable, you know, staying standards versus in the coastal zone versus in the rest of the city.
Okay, so who else has comments on 5.4 and 5.5? Go ahead, Commissioner Maynard.
Well, first I'll stay in keeping with that and ask a question about development. Brian Troutwine from the Environmental Defense Center submitted a comment that I shared with Wendy and Ann fairly late, so I'm not sure if it made it to everybody else, but I thought it was an interesting point. He had said that he was curious if vegetation removal would be included in the development, and said that the county recently closed the loophole in its Eastern Goleta Valley Community Plan ordinance, which had allowed unregulated clearing of ESH vegetation in the inland area with no review or mitigation as long as no development was proposed. But since adoption of the EGVCP in October-November 2005, the county now regulates ESHA vegetation removal above exempt limits, as well as development in ESH in the Eastern Goleta Valley Community Plan. So I thought this was an important point to consider, and I'm curious first for a clarification of whether this development would include vegetation removal if there's no structure being added.
The definition of development, and again, this is consistent with the Coastal Act, does include the grading, removing of any materials. Okay. So, but you do get to a point in where you're looking at the potential environmental effects of new development, and typically when, say, it's on what you have a lot in Goleta of single family development and smaller lots, it's kind of assumed that that entire lot is going to be used for residential purposes and not protected in habitat. So typically what I understand the city's done is through their developments is those sensitive areas are protected or in the open space parcels. And so they have some protection. Where you do have some different cases is in the more historical development where something was subdivided or developed, you know, kind of before those protections were put in place. But typically, especially, again, with the type of development you see in Goleta, you in the environmental review, you're considering that the entirety of that residential lot is going to be used. Okay. So it's a little bit of a different case than in a county setting, again, where you may have larger lots and more rural type of development.
Okay. Great. I have some additional comments on this page. So this is continuing from the last page. So one question that I do have, looking at the list that started on the last page and continues to this page through F and I here, there was a number of sections that were in the conservation element of the general plan that don't appear here, and some of which are certainly connected to ESHAs, but a little bit more indirectly. So I'll use the example of energy efficiency. It seems like, were those intentionally taken out? And if so, where does that come back up? Or is it lost because we haven't brought it over to the zoning ordinance?
Well, I'd have to see the exact policy. Mm-hmm. There were some, I know that you referenced in a comment letter, and some of those were about addressed in the shoreline section, which is later. There are some things in the general plan that don't come into the zoning. So there may be things that are more programmatic, mm-hmm. or they may be addressed in ways that may not be a literal word-for-word mm-hmm. addressing. I think one example you had of the oil and gas, facilities.
That one will come a little bit later. Oh, okay. I'm going to comment on that in a few pages. The one I'm referring to here, this is under the guiding principles and goals for the conservation element. It's 4.214 in the general plan, and it says encourage energy efficiency in new development, encourage use of alternative energy sources such as solar energy. I don't know where that would end up.
So a lot of that is in the provisions to allow for solar facilities and the alternative energy, the wind turbines, and so on. It's more incorporated kind of throughout.
Okay. So given that context, and thank you for clarifying that, I'll say the ones out of this list that I think should have been carried over still. So still in the general plan 4.2, number 12, I think that conserve soil resources as the foundation of resource production and minimize erosion and other soil depleting processes should have also been included in this list, as well as minimize emissions of atmospheric pollutants that result from new development within Goleta. I think both of those are very important for protecting ESHAs and should have been included in the purpose section here. So I will note both of those two.
And now, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Not to belabor the point with staff, but under the biological study on page 54B, we're talking about habitat area with 100 feet of any portion of the proposed development. And I just would like to, I wonder if there is some type of compromise that between staff's differing viewpoints on this that we might reach some type of understanding. And that is, if the property line is within 100 feet of that ESHA, but the building footprint or the proposed footprint is outside of that 100 feet. To me, if you're going to throw the book at them, it's rather onerous. You're going to force them to hire a professional biologist and spend tens of thousands of dollars to do this study. And it just seems over the top. And so I think if you're adding a portion to a home that is within the 100 feet, then yes, I can understand that level of study, but I can't otherwise.
Okay.
Thank you.
So we are now on page 56 and 57, unless anybody feels I left them out on the last pages. No. Nope. Mr. Fuller, what do you have for us on 56 and 57?
I think I'm good.
Okay. Mr. Daniels, anything 56, 57?
1731050, development standards.
Uh-huh.
I probably missed a lot of these when I was reading through the rest of the documents, but there was two that caught my eye, one within A and one within C. Development standards need to be specific. And to get specific, you can ask your biologist who's doing the report to have the critter corridors be a certain feet away from each other, not sufficient width. Okay. I mean, it's different, but you gotta think about enforcement when you look at those, mm-hmm. and you can't enforce sufficient width. Mm-hmm. And in C, that was A. In C, Yeah, vegetated buffers must be salvage and or reestablish vegetation that supports the wildlife whenever feasible. Well, that's a weasel word as well. I'd like to see, you know, something tangible there to help with the enforcement of the development standard. Mm-hmm. That's something global. If I've missed it, others that have that, I apologize. But I think they need to be taken a look at. Because that's something that a biologist would be happy to do.
Thank you, Commissioner Daniels. Mm-hmm. Who have I not given 56 and 57 to? Did I give it to you, Mr. Jenkins?
No, but I don't have anything.
Okay. Commissioner Fuller?
You started with me, Chair.
Oh, I did. I shouldn't end with you then, right? Commissioner Maynard.
Oh. So I will first just echo what Commissioner Daniels said. I think he made some wonderful points that I would support. For 1731050, this standard requires that any protect, I believe that's project. And in general, there's several places in here where in the general plan it says within or adjacent to an ESHA. And here it says that could cause potential impact to an ESHA, and maybe that's clarified in the applicability section, but I just noticed that as a wording difference and wasn't sure if that was intentional or clarified in another way.
All right, Commissioner Maynard, why don't you take the next two pages, 58 and 59?
Did you comment on 56 and 57? Did you want to?
No, I think I was the first, yeah.
Okay, so 58 and 59. This is on page 59, 1731060B. There was a comment from the public that encouraged us to consider prohibiting insecticides, herbicides, and other toxic substances instead of minimizing them, and I support that public comment. And that's my only thing on these two pages.
All right. Commissioner Fuller?
No good.
Comment? Okay. Commissioner Jenkins, anything on 58 and 59?
The fence height, I'm assuming that's coming from some reference. Just seems like fences 40 inches high, a little low, but I don't know if that's for raptors concern or what's involved with that. And then Commissioner Maynard, the 14 inches above the ground, a lot of raccoons are going to be getting at the trash cans, but yeah. That's just an observation.
Okay. Commissioner Daniels, anything on 58 and 59?
Yes, I would like to have a discussion about grading. In H of page 58, you talk about the timing of grading and construction. You don't tell me what kind of grading you're talking about. In my work, we know about mass grading and final grading. That's definitely the two different things. Mass grading is earth moving, and the I says earth moving, but it doesn't say mass grading there, and we need to make it clear which grading you're talking about. The second grading would be final grading, and those that's like trenching the utilities and other items like that. Mm-hmm. So you know you can understand that, you know, you got earth moving, right, and then you've got just got the simple trenching, mm-hmm. And that's final so. If you could take a look at that, that'd be great. It's on page 58.
Chair Onan, before we move to the next page, I do have one thought that Commissioner Jenkins made me think of. So if there's a moment before the next page, can you let me know?
Before
we get to 60?
Sure. Yeah, did anybody else have a chance at 58, 59?
Yes.
How about now?
Great. So as I was listening to Commissioner Jenkins' comments, it made me really think about how these fencing regulations here interplay with the other fencing regulations we've talked about in the prior section, and maybe there needs to be some clarity about when one comes into play or which one trumps the other, because as you rightly said, this is a fencing that's designed for raccoons to go under because it's supposed to be wildlife permeable, right, which is important for Esha, but then potentially causes challenges for the other guidelines we talked about earlier. So I would just note that we should think about which guideline trumps the others and how those interplay with each other.
I was being very facetious.
Completely understandable at 9 o'clock. So we're going to go a little longer here. How much more stamina do we have? How we're doing? I don't see anybody keeling over, so we're going for the rest of it. So, Mr. Fuller, how about 60 and 61?
Right, I'm good.
Commissioner Maynard, 60 and 61?
For on page 60, number one, I do believe. Would like clarification on who the review authority here is, and would like to see both Planning Commission and City Council comment on this. The creek buffers is just something very important to many community members, and so I think it's something that definitely has to come to the commission level. And the other question I had, and this went back to our definitions from the beginning, I brought this up a little bit, but I want to mention it here, is that what if somebody's digging underground and not necessarily building something above ground? I wouldn't want them to build underground in that 100-foot area. So I think that's something I wanted to, I didn't know if that was included in this definition or not. And one of the public comments recommended that instead of doing not less than 25 feet as an exception, we did not less than 50 feet as an exception, and I support that public comment. And I have no comments on page 61.
All right, and we had you, Mr. Fuller, already. Mm-hmm. Commissioner Jenkins? Commissioner Daniels?
Yes, thank you. This is to Commissioner Maynor. I believe you're talking about the fish and wildlife that used to be fish and game. They've changed their name to fish and wildlife for obvious reasons. What I'm looking for is, did you have any chance to look at what the fish and wildlife proposed as mitigation for restoring creeks and getting into creeks at all? So I think it would be good if you had that information with you when you were doing this section. Maybe you did, maybe you didn't. I mean, I don't know that. I think it's important to have that.
Okay. I would just make a comment. We had a comment of reducing the setback or the minimum setback, and as that comment is made, I would say that I'm not supporting raising the or changing the minimum setback. Obviously, that's a much broader policy basis that we're conforming to here. But I think that has had a lot of public process that went into it as well.
If the commission would like to recommend to council that they consider a general plan amendment to do so, that would be great. Whatever you decide, but we are using general plan language and not proposing any general plan amendments with this ordinance.
Okay. One clarification: can you define the review authority for us?
It's planning commission or council, depending on who's hearing the item, making the final decision.
Okay, thank you for that clarification. That is what I was hoping.
Ms. Miller? Oh,
did we have anything? No. We're going to page 62 and 63.
Commissioner Fuller, anything there?
No.
Commissioner Maynard, 62-63?
I do have a few comments. So for this one, in the general plan language, it says, so for 1731-080 in the general plan CE 3.1, it does say the most protective of definitions shall be applied and used to determine the boundary of a wetland. The city of Goleta uses the identification of a single indicator of soil hydrology or plants to determine the boundary of the wetland. Does that appear somewhere else in the zoning code, or could that appear here to be consistent with general plan? So that's one comment. And then I also did have the comment about the approval authority. So for 1731-080, there is in B, where it talks about the buffer. I just wanted clarification of who the approving authority is there.
Okay. 62, and anything on 63?
Yes, I did. And on 63, similarly, 1731-090A, I also wanted a definition of the approving authority. And that is all my comments.
Okay. And Commissioner Fuller, we already had you. Commissioner Jenkins, 62 and 63. Commissioner Daniels, 62 and 63.
Yes, just an FYI, the discussion that you have on restoration of degraded creeks. I hope you'll look at Fish and Wildlife. And on 63, you've got wetlands outside of the coastal zone. So, they're going to be real interested in that.
Okay, 64 and 65, Commissioner Daniels, anything there?
I think I've made my point.
Okay. Commissioner Jenkins, 64 and 65.
I don't believe so, Mr. Chair.
Commissioner Fuller?
No.
Commissioner Maynard?
So under 1731-140C, which is on page 65, mitigation of impacts to native trees, in the general plan it says that the tree replacement ratios will be established by the tree protection ordinance. Do we have that?
No, we do not. No. Not at this time.
Okay. Are we still going to be developing that, or is that on delay at this point?
It's on delay.
Okay.
Well, it's post-zoning ordinance.
Post-zoning ordinance. It might be good to reference the plan, that there's still a commitment or plan to do that here, that ordinance is in place, that this would link back to that.
You wouldn't actually put it in the ordinance. We would, when the ordinance comes through, you would do a text change to the zoning ordinance to make that reference.
Okay. All right. Then... Okay, and then the review authority would, again, be either Planning Commission or City Council?
It's whoever is approving the project.
Who's ever approving the project. Okay. And then I know the campus has had to move to a plant three trees to one tree that we take up ratio, so I don't know if that could be considered here as a potential benchmark, but I know that's something we've had to do with our new planning projects.
Okay, so that was 64 and 65. Did I go to you on that one, Mr. Fuller?
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Jenkins, did I do you already?
Yes, you did.
Okay. Mr. Daniels, 64, 65?
Nothing, sir.
66, 67, Mr. Daniels.
67. 1731-170A3. Removal of vegetation, and this is about monarch butterflies protection standards. Removal of vegetation, and it gets into other interesting. Is that city workers or is that anybody?
That would be anybody.
Anybody?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and that you might say that. Because otherwise, it's just a free for all.
Beyond.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Daniels.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Jenkins, 6667?
No, but I think Commissioner Daniels brings up a good point, just as far as are we allowing the public to go in and prune in the butterfly habitat area? It just seems, is that okay?
Are they allowed to ever prune on city property?
That is public land, isn't it?
Yeah.
So I don't know if any clarification would be helpful.
Mr.
My only comment would be if you know, we want to prohibit people pruning any monarch vegetation, we should pass a separate ordinance, you know, for the city that prohibits people from, you know, doing that. So everybody blanket is prohibited. I mean, this is a zoning ordinance that refers to development standards. So within a development, nobody's allowed to do more than a minor pruning of trees or removal of dead trees. That's how I see it. I could be wrong.
Commissioner Maynard?
My comment would be in regards to the marine protected habitat section, and this is 1731-160. In the general plan, it has some language about oil facilities, and I believe we had some clarification on that. Did that get moved to the oil and gas production facility section later that we're going to discuss? I can read the section from the general plan if that's helpful.
I think it's just the organization of it, since this is about the protection of the marine habitats, and we don't allow oil and gas facilities. Those are non-conforming, and this section is specifically about protection of marine habitats. Mm-hmm. So it was moved into the oil and gas section.
Okay, then I will bring my comment back up when we get to the oil and gas section. Thank you.
Okay, Commissioner Maynard, you're going to do our last couple pages here. Mm-hmm. Start us off, 6869.
I'm going to start with several comments. page 68, 1731-180. I think this might have been addressed, but there are a couple of sections that were missing from the general plan. And so I wanted clarification of if those were moved, where those were moved to. So this is in the last section of the conservation element where it does talk about, for example, the dunes and the seabird nest areas. CE, conservation element 7.3, 7.4, 7.5, 7.6, and 7.7 have not carried over into this. And I would like to know that those were carried into other areas of the zoning ordinance, and I'm just, which it sounds like it is, but I would like some clarification or confirmation of that.
Those sections are in the hazards section of the ordinance, so you'll be reviewing them.
Great. Okay, that was what I wanted to know. And then under 1731-180B, the seabird nest areas, there is one sentence in the general plan that was removed from here that I think should be added back in for consistency with the general plan, and that is new structures must be prohibited on bluff faces except for stairs, ramps, or trails to provide public beach access, and that's from general plan conservation element 7.8, and is the second sentence that does appear right after this sentence in the general plan, so I think it's worth pulling that language over. And that is all from me.
Commissioner Fuller.
I'm good.
Commissioner Jenkins.
Just a quick question regarding under 180B, seabird nesting areas. And it talks about new pedestrian access is not permitted on bluff faces. And I understand that. But what about the person who is just hiking along? I mean, is there interpretive signs or something that would, you know, advise them of nesting at certain times of the year so that they would be aware not to go traipsing around where they shouldn't?
Currently there are signs on UCSB's Colo Point Reserve, and we do have some signage at the city of Goleta at our parking lot.
Okay.
There'll be more in the future, but we need to go through a permit process for that.
Okay, thank you.
Commissioner Daniels, anything on these two?
Nothing, sir.
Okay, so I believe that was our goal, was to get to this point. Was that correct?
I wrote stop.
Wow. He wrote the top. I thought that was, we're going to take up floodplain management as our start point next time?
Yeah.
Okay. Good job, everybody. So let's go and button this meeting up. We're going to go to the director's report.
Okay. You've all been contacted about a potential meeting, special meeting on February 29th. And we've heard back from three of you, so please check your email. We're having, because we've advertised these planning commission meetings as zoning, we're really hesitant to put any other items on, especially because we want to keep everyone focused. So that's why we're going to need to do business at a special meeting. We have a number of applications that are sitting out there. There is some new laws regarding shot clocks on timing for processing of cellular applications, and that's what we're going to be coming to you with. And there's other fun stuff too, but nothing incredibly controversial. Last council meeting, there was first read on our model water efficient landscape ordinance that the state has put forward. Essentially, we've adopted it in total, but where it says local agency, we put Goleta, local water purveyor, we put Goleta Water District. We've made it our own. Second read will be on February 16th. Also on February 16th, there will be a discussion of our sphere of influence and whether or not the City Council would like to pursue any sort of discussion of expansion. If we can't do the expansion, it would be a request to LAFCO to consider an expansion. And so that item will also be discussed. And I also wanted to clarify, again, based on some of the comments that I heard tonight, I will be taking to DRB tomorrow the design question. We're going to be starting back with the base districts and going through all those design elements just to get their opinion, whether or not they feel that a very base level of something should be in the ordinance for people's use, or whether or not they think guidelines should be pursued as well, and what their actual comments are on those issues. So I'll be reporting back once I get their comments. So, that's all.
That's it?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Any comments from the commissioners?
I have one question. There was some comments from the public about the SAIR being available at the library. Can you confirm that that was done?
It was. We've had some problems with folks stealing documents. We had our SAIR stolen from our front counter, but we did receive confirmation from the librarians at the library that it was there. We were going to get selfies taken with it, but we took verbal confirmation instead.
I do appreciate you checking on that. Thank you.
Commissioner Fuller?
Good.
Commissioner Daniels, any commissioner comments?
No, thank you.
Commissioner Jenkins?
No.
No, me as well. So with that, is there a motion to adjourn?
Also, on the SEIR timeline, I think I did remember seeing one public comment that said that there was maybe some of the timeline wasn't entirely clear. Could you send us a copy of the current timeline for when the reports are due? I know one of the emails that I received said that the website was maybe inconsistent with one of the printed documents, and maybe there was some confusion there. Could you send us a copy of just what the current timeline for the SEIR is?
We can certainly do that. It's also on GoletaZoning.com, and I think that person that had that confusion, it was on the notice of preparation, an old notice from over a year ago. So I think that was a confusion, but yes, what's on the website and what was noticed physically mailed out, that's accurate, but we can send you the link.
Thank you very much. And now I will support the closing of the meeting.
All right, there was a motion. Do I have a second?
Second.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
I heard no objections. So this meeting is adjourned.